This is Dr. Laura Coffins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University. I'm conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Michael McGregor. The date is 16th of December 2003. I am in the Special Collections building on the campus of Texas Tech University in Lubbock, Texas. And Mr. McGregor is in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Is that right, sir?
Yes.
Okay. Let's begin, Mike, if we can, just by discussing some general background information. Can you tell me when and where you were born, and maybe a little about your childhood?
Okay, well, I was born in South Bend, Indiana, on February 5th, 1943. I was the youngest of two children. Mm-hmm. My father was in the Army when I was born. He was basically a career soldier. He was in for kind of hard to figure out, but when I was born, he was in about 18, 19 years, and then he was subsequently killed on D-Day on Omaha Beach in 1944. So I basically grew up with a kind of an extended family. There's my brother and I, my widowed mother, and she lived with a widowed sister, and they both lived with their parents. So I had a grandmother, two mothers really, and a grandfather, and my brother. So I lived in South Bend, grew up in South Bend, kind of, you know, uneventful childhood. Lived there, went to parochial Catholic school through nine grades, then went to a public high school. Played some football and baseball. Went to college. Did my first 2 years at the Indiana University Extension Center in South Bend, and my last 2 years at IU Bloomington, graduating in 65 with a degree in history.
Okay, Mike, can I ask you a couple of questions about that?
Sure.
Did your mom work outside the house after she was widowed?
She did part-time until we were, basically part-time most of the time.
What'd she do?
Well, she worked in a meat market for a while, and then she was a policewoman.
She was a policewoman?
Yeah.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
How did that come about, you know?
I think a lot. She didn't, other than the $10,000 GI insurance, she didn't get any VA benefits
or
anything. They didn't have that then.
That's
and
right.
Most of the cops were veterans.
Yeah.
And I think they just looked after, you know, people that, you know. She never really said. And she worked, it was like a part-time job as basically dealing with schools, you know, with traffic safety. And, the schools weren't like they were today. You know, you didn't have to worry about guns and stuff. And I think she got involved in some truancy kinds of issues. But basically traffic safety, you know, for the kids. And, every school had their patrol boys that would, you know, like crossing guards at intersections and that, and, you know, worked with those kids and trained them and that kind of stuff.
Do you think she enjoyed that work?
Oh, yeah, she loved it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she did it until she and we were way gone through how, and she retired out of that, yeah.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So was that like a 20-year stint or something that she
Probably more than that.
Really?
I think she started probably in the real early 50s doing that. And then she had a couple other part-time jobs, you know, with that as well. And I'm not sure if she was still doing it when I was. I think she was doing it into the mid-60s, and then she retired.
What was her name?
Alice McGregor.
Okay. And your aunt that you lived with, did she also have jobs outside?
Yeah, she had a full-time job outside the house.
What'd she do?
Yeah, she worked in the office at what used to be Ball Band, which was part of, I think it became part of U.S. Rubber, which became part of Uniroyal, but they had a big factory complex in Mishawaka, Indiana, where they made basically rain boots rain footwear, and then they also did some military work. They made some, rubberized fuel cells and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. And so she was working in the office.
Yeah.
And
I think she was doing order processing or something.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And did she have children as well?
No, she didn't.
Okay.
No, she was widowed. Her husband was a veteran of the First World War who was accidentally killed in the I think, the early 30s. I'm not sure.
Was it a car accident or was it an industrial
accident? No, in fact, he was at an amusement park watching fireworks, and he and a bunch of other guys were sitting on the roof of a building, and the roof collapsed, and he was killed in that.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Wow. Can we talk about your father for a minute?
Sure.
You said that he was career Army.
Yeah.
What was his rank when the World War II began?
When it began, he was either second or a first lieutenant, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. I have to go back on my dad. I don't know much about my father because he was a, his real name was Wilson.
Okay.
And he was, I pieced this together, well, my mom told me some of this. He grew up in Delaware. He was the middle of three children.
Mm-hmm.
He idolized his older brother. His mother died. His father remarried, and his older brother was complaining of a stomach ache and how I guess my dad portrayed it to my mom, the cruel stepmother wouldn't do anything, and probably just thought the kid had a stomach ache, go to bed, you'll feel better in the morning, and
mm-hmm.
then he died of a ruptured appendix. So my father got very upset about that, and he just ran away from home. And he changed his name from Wilson to McGregor, and poked around the country, was out west for a while, fell in love, I guess, with horses, worked on some ranches, and then ended up joining the Army so he could get into the cavalry. And this was probably, as I can piece it together, this was maybe, because he was born in 1903, so this was probably in the early 20s that he joined the Army. I tried to get his records, but they were in that part of the building in St. Louis that got all that burned up a few years ago.
Yeah.
So then he was an enlisted man in the cavalry for many years. And I think he was commissioned, he got a regular Army commission in, I believe it was 37 or 38. Because I have that, that's at home,
mm-hmm.
The document commissioning him.
What unit was he with?
Well, when?
Which units was he ever with that you know?
Well, he was in the 7th Cavalry for a while.
Okay.
He was with the, he was on the, in the 3rd Brigade of the 2nd Cavalry Division,
mm-hmm.
which was formed, pre Second World War, maybe 41 before Pearl Harbor. And then he got out of that, and I guess they decided they didn't need horse cavalry, so they mechanized, and then that was disbanded, and he then went, I'll get to where he went, and then later, the 2nd Cavalry was reactivated, but he didn't go there because it was reactivated as a black unit, and then it was, I think they shipped overseas, and then it was disbanded, but he left the 7th Cav when it, I'm sorry, the 2nd Cav when it was being, I guess, disbanded the first time. And he ended up, I don't really know what he did. He cycled around the states for a while, and then he was company commander of the 461st Amphibious Truck Company.
Okay.
And that was a unit that he was with when he shipped over to England. They shipped around Christmas time of 43, I understand. And then they were attached to the 6th Special Engineering Brigade. And then they were, scheduled to go to shore on, I think, D plus 90 minutes on Omaha Beach.
Oh, okay.
That's where he was killed.
Okay. How long had he and your mom been married before he left for England?
Okay. Let's see. He left December of 43. I have to kind of backtrack.
Right.
My mother was, she was born in 1910,
mm-hmm.
and she got married when she was 26. So that would have been in 1936 they got married.
Mm-hmm.
And my brother was born in 41, and then I was born in 43. So he was, they were married, what, maybe 9 years before when he shipped out?
And did your father write letters to your mom
Yeah.
when he was over there? Do you have any of those?
Yeah, I have a bunch of them, yeah.
Oh, really? And
not so much when, I, 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 well, I haven't gone through all of them. She saved a bunch, and when my mother passed away, I got them. My wife got them out of her place, and I have them here. And it was going to be one of my retirement jobs. I think I'm going to catalog those and just see what's there. But a lot of them are when he was in the States. I'm not sure how much he wrote when he was, you know, overseas.
Right. But you have a goodly collection of letters.
Yeah, there's probably 50, 60 of them, yeah.
And your mom never remarried.
No, she didn't.
Do you know where your father's buried?
Yeah, he's buried in the U.S. Military Cemetery in Cambridge, England.
Have you been over there?
I went there. I took my son there. Oh, when was that? It's probably 3-4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we went.
And how was that? Was it very emotional for you, or?
A little bit. You know, I've never known. I never really knew him. So
right.
I just, one of my goals in life was to see his grave, and researching the thing. I really feel sorry for my mother, because mm-hmm. she was she was a Polish lady, and they really like to honor their dead and go to cemeteries and, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
And because she had the option of bringing him back after the war, and she chose not to because she said she didn't want to disturb his grave. But in my research, I found out that, you know, he was interred in a temporary cemetery, and then when she declined that, he was then permanently interred in Cambridge.
And, of course, that wasn't explained to her.
No, it wasn't. So, you know, but it was kind of, you know, it was kind of sad, kind of bittersweet. But the thing that got me the most was, it really put it in perspective. The cemetery is beautifully maintained.
Yes.
And we were treated like kings when, you know, we went there. And there's two you know, U.S. people, you know, in charge, you know, like the cemetery managers or whatever, and
mm-hmm.
and they've been over backwards to help us and that. But there's they have a reflecting pond. On one hand is a nice chapel, and on the other hand, on the other end is the colors. And on the one side they have a wall, and on the wall there's probably 50,000 names
mm-hmm.
of these are people who were killed, but they didn't recover their body.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it, I said, gee, you know, here on our wall for Vietnam, we got, you know, total, what, 55,000 names, and here's just one little bitty cemetery that,
right.
It just,
one
you know,
of,
it just like hit me in the stomach. I said, you know, wow, you know, it's, yeah, and Glenn Miller's name was on there. I found Glenn Miller's
right?
name,
uh-huh.
and yeah,
uh-huh.
yeah, and that kind of stuff. That was, you know, it really kind of put everything in perspective, you know, and then
yeah.
we went over to France and then looked toward the beaches and that kind of thing. Yeah, it was. And all I have to say is I take my hats off to those guys. They had guts. I don't think I could have done what they did.
I mean,
it was amazing. I mean, and literally, and these guys had to hump the beach, you know, maybe quarter to half a mile before you even get to the hills, and they got these huge bunkers, and I can just imagine how they just, you know.
It's horrific.
Wow.
It's horrific.
Yeah, it was terrible.
Yeah. Did your mom ever make it over to
No,
Cambridge?
She didn't.
Okay, did she?
I wanted to take her. You know, my brother and I were going to take her. He said, standing time, she did not want to go. So,
uh-huh.
I respect her wishes.
Absolutely, yeah. So you were in parochial school.
Yeah.
And was that kind of a good experience, or how did it come about that you were sent there?
Well, the neighborhood I grew up in was. It's kind of funny because it was fairly integrated, but it was still the old Polish. So we lived with my grandparents, the old Polish
yes.
working class, you know, housing and
sure.
Neighborhoods. And the church had the school, and the church was just a block and a half away, and that's
oh.
where everybody went to church. You went to school there.
Uh huh. And so your mom was working in the public schools.
Yeah, as well as with the private schools.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So she did come around to the
oh yeah
the parochial
yeah,
schools
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
Did you come to your school?
Yeah.
Did it make it kind of difficult for you? Did guys rib you about that? Or?
Oh, no, huh?
No? Okay.
No.
Okay.
No, but, you know, we knew, you know, I mean, the kids that you went to school with were the kids that lived next door that, you know,
okay.
it was, there's, you know, in my class there was maybe two kids that had to ride the bus to come to school. Everybody else walked. So, you know, you lived close to each other, you played at the same parks or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And everybody kind of grew up knowing that your mom was, you know, in the police service.
Mm-hmm.
And you said that you you played some sports.
Yes.
Can you tell me about that? When did that start?
Well, I guess you'd call it equivalent of junior high, you know,
sure.
sixth, seventh, eighth grade, played, uh-huh. you know, football, basketball, baseball. Then in high school, played football and basketball.
Were you any good?
Oh, good enough, you know. I was too slow to get a scholarship to college, but it was, I had fun. I held my own.
What positions did you play, say, in football?
I was basically a defensive end and played tight end on offense. And that way, back then, we went both ways
uh-huh.
a lot of the times. So.
Uh-huh. What kind of schools did you play? Did you play other parochial schools or schools there in South Bend? Or?
Oh, yeah, the parochial schools in South Bend and in high school. Then we played, they had like a parochial school league for, you know, the elementary school. We played there.
Mm-hmm.
And then in high school we went to, in fact, I got a football scholarship to a Catholic high school, but I only did 1 year there.
Okay, and then you went to?
I went to public school.
Which high school?
South Bend Central.
South Bend Central, okay. And what year did you graduate?
1961.
What kind of student were you in high school?
Mediocre. If you look at grade point, I probably had maybe a 2.4, 2.5, something like that in high school.
Uh-huh.
I didn't study too much.
What subjects were your best ones?
History.
Uh-huh.
Liked history. Had a couple history teachers that really turned me on. And English, I have to say. And I had sophomore. English, but you know, later, junior English, and then I took some electives in English in my senior year. I really liked that.
Was it the teachers that kind of led you to the subjects that you found you liked, or did you find them on your own and then happen to?
Well, I just signed up for a class, and then you know the teachers turned me on and really liked it. You know,
which history? What history did you like? U.S. history or world history?
World history and U.S. history. Yeah.
Okay. And when you decided to go to college, was it clear to you that history was what you were going to do?
Yeah, because I had no idea. I didn't really have any very very good counseling, you know, career counseling and that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
It's just I just liked history and said, hey, I think I'll major in history. You know?
Had your brother gone on to college as well?
No, he graduated from high school in '97. No, 97, 98. He's like 2 years behind me, and he joined the Marines right away. He went in the Marine Corps.
Oh, he did.
Yeah.
Why?
And then when
go ahead.
I have no idea why. What he took growing up without a father a lot tougher than I did. It,
uh-huh.
it bothered him a lot, and he had a lot of issues too. He's always kind of a quiet guy, and I think he had a lot of issues to work out. So. He's a real surprise. I remember my mother was shocked when he came home and said, hey, I'm going in the Marine Corps.
He hadn't told her that was his plan?
No.
And he was already...
He already had enlisted, yeah.
How long did he have between the time he told her and the time he needed to report? Do you know?
Maybe a couple, 3 weeks, maybe.
And how did your mom take that?
Well, she was upset, you know. She didn't want any of her kids in the service. You know, she lost a husband that took away her husband, so she was upset about it. Because, you know, as my dad was had a commission in the regular Army, so if we passed the test, we could have gotten in any service academy that we wanted. And she steered us away from that.
Did that make a difference to you, not trying to get to the service academies?
Oh, I did not want to go into service.
You were against that idea.
I didn't want the military. that was the furthest thing from my mind, and I tried everything not to go.
Okay, well, I'm going to ask you about that.
Yeah.
How long did your brother stay in the Marines?
4 years.
Okay.
Then he came out. Then he went to college.
Okay. Where did he go?
Indiana.
Okay, so was he on campus at Bloomington the same time as you?
No, he got out of the Marines. It would have been in 63. So then he did a couple years at the extension in South Bend.
Okay.
They had a campus. Back then, you could only do 2 years off campus, and then you had to go do your last 2 years on campus.
Mm-hmm.
Now I think all these things are standalone degree granting. So he did his 2 years there, and then, well, he basically did, yeah, I think he did his 2 years there, and then he went on campus, and he spent 12 months on campus, and he compressed the other 2 years into basically a year in a summer school. He really took a heavy load, and then
wow.
He graduated.
What was his major?
Finance.
And did he go into some kind of career that was related to that right away?
Yeah, he did. And then he went to work for Sarah Passwell Cross because he went to work for City Service Oil Company in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Okay.
And then I did my AIT at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, so he'd come over and see me a few times.
Oh, okay.
And give me some hints on how to survive in the military.
Right, because he was an old hand by then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he did some. He didn't graduate from law school, but he attended the University of Tulsa's law school part-time for a while.
Mm-hmm. So when you went to IU in South Bend, were you living at home?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How did that work out?
One, great.
Yeah?
Yeah,
so you were a college man.
Yeah.
And were most of the people that you were hanging out with, friends and so forth, were they from college, or were they people that you had known while you were growing up?
Well, basically people from the neighborhood and that, because the college didn't have, it was basically just commuter students.
Right.
You know, they didn't have any dorms or, you know, anything. They didn't have any housing.
Mm-hmm. Was there any kind of social activities around going to IU South Bend?
I'm sure there was. I didn't really partake into too many of them.
Okay.
Because I was working part time, and then I had a girlfriend, and uh-huh. You know, I ended up marrying. And
where were you working?
Well, I did a lot of day labor. I was in the Teamsters, so I would get called to help, you know, if I was available to help unload trucks, and most of the time with the, you know, Teamster guys that drove moving vans mm-hmm. would go meet them at the site and, you know, work for a day and help them unload or load up. And then I also worked on Saturdays and sometimes during the week late if it was light out with a surveyor who would survey houses for closing for, you know, mortgage purposes.
Right. Checking lot lines and that kind
yeah.
of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And how did you get into that surveying work?
I did that even in high school because my brother worked there. And then when he worked for the individual, and then when he was graduating from high school, hey, you got anybody else? And, you know, and sure, yeah, hire my little brother. So he always handed, you know, he handed me his paper route, he handed me his jobs. And
that was kind of good. That was kind of good.
When you
decided to, well, you were forced to transition to IU Bloomington because you had gone through your 2 years.
Uh-huh.
How did that transition work? Was it smooth for you?
Oh, yeah, it was great. A great time.
Where did you live in Bloomington?
I lived in university housing in
okay.
a dorm.
Uh-huh. And was it fun to move into the dorm?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. Had a good time.
Okay. And at this point, you're still dating?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And when did you actually get married?
August of 65.
Okay. And can you tell me something about the campus atmosphere at Bloomington while you were there?
Well, it was a pretty redneck campus.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, I was, quite frankly, I was shocked because I grew up in northern Indiana, and as I said, my neighborhood was, it was about 25% black, you know, and the folks have been there forever, you know. We'd play ball together, go in, and at Central High, that was a fully integrated school, had, you know, maybe 25-30% of the student body was black, or I guess today the word's African American.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think my senior prom queen was a black gal.
Okay.
So yeah, it was you know, no racial tensions and you know, that kind of stuff. And you know, I get down to southern Indiana, and you know, I found out that Indiana, if you get you know, if you get maybe 25-30 miles south of the you know, the Michigan border, like the edge of Lake Michigan, it was really redneck country.
And what do you mean, for people who might not know in the future, what do you mean by redneck?
I mean, just, you know, I mean, racist.
Okay.
You know, I mean, you know, racist, anti-Semites. You know, I was just shocked, you know, like we had the steam heating. And this one guy was in my room one day, and he said, man, the room was kind of cold. So he said, I'm going to turn the heat on. So they turn the heat on and you hear the, you know, the steam.
Right.
And he said, well, you know, as Adolf would say, there goes another one. And I said, what are you talking about, you idiot? You know, it's, I couldn't believe it, you know.
Wow.
And then, and you get these, and I know I went home with this one, one guy, and, you know, he lived down in, New Albany, Indiana or something, right on the Ohio River. And
Just, and
this was the starting of the civil rights movement, you know, in the States.
Right.
I couldn't understand what the big ado was about because, and then I discovered, geez, you know, they won't even let these people go in and eat some disgusting sandwich that you probably won't want to eat anyway, you know, and it was, I just couldn't believe it. I just shocked.
Did you see a place that had segregated seating?
Well, Indiana wasn't segregated. No, yeah, we were not segregated, but the ideas of the people were.
Okay. You know. But you didn't see a particular place down there in New Albany that was.
No, I didn't say we were just down there real quick. We went down there on a Friday night. I think we came back. I said I got to get back. I got to study. I left on Saturday, you know, afternoon, and drove back to campus.
Right.
It was, but just how they talked, and you know, it just. You know, it was nigger this and nigger that, and you know, something, you know, we never use that word. You know?
Right,
was,
you were shocked.
Yeah, that was, you know, I say, hey, you know, you take the, and I say, well, you got to see how the rest of the world lives, boy. You know, I said, forget it. And then, when was that? That must have been my senior year, I'm not sure.
Uh-huh.
Presidential primaries. George Wallace was running.
Yes.
In the primary, and he came by. He's going to have a big rally on campus, and he couldn't believe the reception this guy got. And there were about four of us on the corner saying, anybody but, you know. I think we had signs that said, anybody but George, and I thought we were going to get killed.
How big was it? It was an outdoor rally, I take it.
I don't know how many people were there. I didn't go. I think he had one in the old football stadium, which then they were using, the only thing they used it for to have that little 500 bicycle race, you know, like they made that movie Breaking Away about.
Uh-huh.
And, I think they had a rally there, and then they had a rally in, one of the residence halls, dining room or something. And he was there.
And he filled them.
Oh yeah. I mean, they're waiting in line to get in. And hey, you can have my place, go on.
Wow. And the students were really enthusiastically.
Yeah, very, very, very much so, yeah.
And did you have conversations with any of these people and try and figure out why they were supporting him?
Did they confront you?
And
sure, he can keep black people down. I mean, he didn't use the word black, but, you know, he's going, we're going to keep these people down. You know, they got another place.
Did you actually, engage in arguments, or were you kind of observing all this and being
Well, involved? You got to understand, I'm, 6'4", at that time, about 235, and, you know, I just don't want to hear that stuff, and they just go away.
Yeah, I bet they did.
Yeah, so, it's, you know, you argued for a while, but you can't convince them, and in fact, a friend of mine, kid I played high school football with, was down there. He was on the football team. He's a black guy on the football team.
On the Indiana University team?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and he was. So he and I would maybe comfort each other every now and then.
What was his name?
Ken Ellis.
Were there other black students that you had some kind of friendships with that you talked about this kind of stuff with?
A few of them, yeah. You know, I didn't really. I basically just concentrated on my studies and interacted with, you know, a few people there because, see, I was still, and now at this time I'm engaged, and my fiance's back in South Bend, so every minute I get, I would, you know, almost every weekend I just drive back and, you know, spend some time with her.
Sure. Well, do you have a sense, or could you convey a sense of how, for example, Ken Ellis felt about the Wallace rallies and how?
Oh, he didn't like it. Obviously, he knew what he was getting into, but he was a smart guy.
Where was he from? Do you know?
South Bend.
Yeah. He was.
We played football at South Bend Central together.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
And he went down on a scholarship. He's a very good football player. And he went down on a scholarship down to IU. Uh-huh. And I did my 2 years in South Bend. And we were both then juniors, you know, when I went down there.
Right, and you kind of hooked up again.
Yeah, I saw him. And, you know, we would chat. But, you know, with football and conditioning. And he was a very smart guy. And he was a shrewd guy. He ended up going to medical school.
Oh, yeah.
And his deal was, I said, well, wait, you know, one time I said, why in the world did you come down here, Kenny? And he said, I snookered these guys. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I said, I'll come play football with you if you can guarantee me that if I meet the grade requirements, I can get in your med school. And I said, oh, yeah, sure. Okay, we can do that.
Probably
a little,
not.
thinking that he probably wouldn't. You know, he's
right.
Just a dumb jock, you know.
Right.
And,
yeah. So he proved them all wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Did he stay at IU for med school then?
You know, we kind of lost track of each other.
Okay.
I'm not sure. I think he did, but I'm not sure. And I know, because he lived about a block from where my mother lived. And then he lived in a, I think his dad was dead. He just lived with his mother, and then his mother moved. So we kind of lost any contact.
Right. When you were studying history, let's talk about your studies for a minute.
Okay.
Were you paying attention to reading the papers and seeing what was going on, for example, in Southeast Asia? Did that?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I stayed on that. In fact, I had a couple guys who were vets that were in my on the same floor in my dorm. And, you know, and thinking back, you know, they'd bring out the paper, yeah, we're working up to it, we'll be over there. And I said, why is that? Look, they're publicizing all these atrocities and all this kind of stuff. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, hopefully we'll be over there. Who knows, you know.
Where had they been? Do you know, were they Korean war vets or were they? No,
they were just, you see, back then, you know, a lot of people were getting drafted.
Yes.
I mean, as I say, when you got out of high school, you know, you either got married, you went to college and, you know, got a student deferment, or you got drafted.
Mm-hmm.
So these were guys that, you know, apparently laid out of school and they got drafted. And then they did their 2 years and said, geez, I'd rather, you know, I better, the Army can be a wake-up call, you
uh-huh.
know,
oh,
so
yeah.
I better do something with my life kind of thing.
And what did you think after they had kind of pointed out to you the possibility of U.S. military involvement? What were you thinking about that? Do you remember?
I didn't really think much about it. Oh, well, you know, that's, you know, it'll be a little war, I guess, but I didn't, you know, and never imagined it would be the, you know, the breadth and scope that it was now, because we were getting those scares all the time, like, hey, they're going to take over Laos, so then we land the Marines over in Thailand, and then that kind of cools down for a little while, and, you know, that kind of stuff was happening, you know, we were playing games, I guess, with the, you know, with the communists or whatever.
Right. Do you remember the Cuban Missile Crisis?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What do you remember about it?
I remember everybody was scared, you know, and, you know, there was a sense of outrage that the, you know, that the Russians had missiles in Cuba. And
mm-hmm.
I wasn't very popular. I said, well, so what? We got missiles in Turkey, you know, just 90 miles away from Russia. Big deal. You know,
right.
They're not going to blow us away. But, you know, in retrospect, I guess I should have paid more attention to it, because I think we came pretty close to something there. But
mm-hmm.
I didn't, you know, I wasn't that preoccupied. You know, I was a young man in love trying to get out of college and, you know,
right,
get
right.
on with my life.
Right. Did you have any sense of Kennedy's performance as a president?
He was elected. I wasn't a big Kennedy fan. My family was pretty much Democratic, but, I applauded, you know, what he wanted to do, but he wasn't able to do much, you know.
Right.
You know, like on the civil rights, area and,
mm-hmm.
and that kind of thing. And, I really didn't really have an opinion one way or another.
Okay, and how did you feel about President Johnson? You talked about the primary elections developing in 1963-64. How did you feel about President Johnson?
Well, I thought it was the thing I remember. I used to go in this one bar and have a couple of beers at night every now and then. And they had I didn't have a TV in my campus housing, and they had a TV there, and I saw this Goldwater commercial.
Mm-hmm.
Or no, this Johnson commercial against Goldwater. Right. So there's a little girl playing in this field. I think they're a bunch of daisies.
Yes.
And she was sitting there and picking daisy, and then a big mushroom cloud comes up.
Yes.
And I said, and I thought that, you know, geez, maybe Johnson's pretty cool because it looks like old Goldwater's a warmonger or something, you know. But that's the only memory of that election that I have other than that, you know, hey, stop Wallace kind of stuff.
Did you then graduate in 1964?
1965. Graduated in 65.
What was it, in June of 65?
June of 65.
Okay. And what happened after graduation?
Well, I took a job with the U.S. Public Health Service, and I was a syphilis epidemiologist, believe it or not.
How did you get that job with a history degree?
Well, I just interviewed. They were on campus interviewing. I had no idea what I wanted to do. I had taken some education classes, and in fact, I even student taught. I took a bunch of education electives, and I decided I didn't want to teach after student teaching.
Uh-huh.
And so I just interviewed, and it sounded like fun, you know. So
what kind of work did you do for the PhD?
Well, there's myself. Well, I was assigned to Columbus, Ohio, and the southeast quarter of Ohio. And
okay.
we were employed by the U.S. Public Health Service, but we were on loan to the Ohio Department of Health. And there were three of us in Columbus that covered this territory, two new guys, myself and this other fellow, and then a guy who's been there for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And our job was to trace the source and spread of reported cases of syphilis.
So this was kind of intelligence work in a way.
Yeah, basically what we had to do is when somebody was diagnosed, back then they had mandatory reporting requirements. You know, if a doctor diagnosed somebody as, you know, with syphilis, they had to report it just like they did TB or, you know, some other stuff.
Right.
And then we would get on the thing and try to determine where that person got the infection from and who they passed it off to.
And so you had to interview them personally?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, interview, do some field blood tests, and, you know, on the people that they named and, you know, that kind of stuff.
And you're interviewing them about very personal stuff.
Yeah.
How did that go?
Well, sometimes with some people very difficult and other times very easy, you know, and then they gave us some pretty good training in terms of interviewing. I know we had to go down to, we spent about a month down at the CDC headquarters in Atlanta getting trained on interviewing techniques and that kind of thing.
Uh-huh. And did you have to file reports on everyone you had evaluated or?
Basically we would, I can't remember what, we had some paperwork that we had to do, but it was kind of minimal, you know, that's, we had to, like, if I interviewed you and you named three people, then I'd have to fill out a contact report that, you know, that you named those three people and then hopefully find them and then get a disposition on them.
Okay.
And if they were then infected, now I knew where their source was, and then I'd have to trace their spread.
Okay. And what was the information used for? The information, it was just primarily used to track down?
Yeah, track the individuals down and make sure they got, you know, that they were tested. And nine times out of ten, they were even if they tested negative, they were prophylactically treated.
With what?
Penicillin.
Okay.
You know, it's, like 3 million units of bicillin will do it, you know, will clear it up pretty well.
Okay. Who did the blood tests?
Drawing the blood?
Yes.
I did a lot of it. We did a lot of it in the field. We used those old Shepherd vacuum tubes or brought them into a clinic,
uh-huh.
You know, whatever they were comfortable with. You know.
And did the CDC train you how to be a phlebotomist, how to draw?
Well, no, they didn't. We were on loan to the Ohio Department of Health, who then, you know, we spent most of our time in the city of Columbus because that was the biggest,
mm-hmm.
you know, urban area in our territory. And we one of the public health nurses kind of talked us through how to do it, and then we just did it in their public VD clinics until we got the technique down.
Wow.
Hey, it's really pretty easy to do. You know, you just, put, you know, something tight on the arm, and usually with most people, the veins pop right up and, you know, just hit it. But they, we did, you know, it was, hey, you're going to get treated for free. We got to learn, you know.
Right. did you enjoy doing this work?
Yeah, I thought it was a lot of fun. Well, and it was because you were tied to an office or going around
right,
a lot, and
right.
You know, and it was, I always liked kind of a challenge to find things, and you know, like you could, well, yeah, there was this guy by the name of Joe, and this is what his car looked like, and da 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 da, and this is where I think he lived, and see if you can find him.
Did you ever feel like you were a police officer, kind of policing people's private lives?
No, huh? Just okay. That, you know, just, you know, our deal was, hey, you know, we don't want you to die.
Okay. Is that because, how you presented it to them?
You know, it's, you know, and quite frankly, that was part of our interviewing techniques because, you know, you get the, you can show some of the manifestations of latent syphilis, and it's not very pretty. And usually people understood, you know, and part of the interviewing thing was just a big education on the disease. And as you're talking, you know, even before you begin talking to the person about, you know, that kind of thing, we would talk to them about the disease and, you know, illustrate the various stages. You know, and a lot of times we're getting a lot of affirmation. Oh, yeah, geez, I had that, but it went away, so I wasn't concerned, you know.
Right.
And, okay,
were
here
people,
you go.
Did you think people were, for the most part, kind of level and straight up with you about?
Everybody was, except the people that I do in jail. And they were weird.
How's that? Can you describe it?
They're very circumspect and play games because they wanted you to keep coming back and coming back and coming back. And okay, well, you got an interview. Hey, can I have one of your cigarettes? Sure, you know, and you know how that, you know, how that would go. And so I think they had a little different agenda. And a lot of times, the biggest resistance we got was in the gay community. Because,
yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
Because the gays were, you know, back then it was against the law.
Yeah.
I mean, really against the law.
Right.
And a lot of vice cops would persecute these poor people. And so that, so it was a very closed community, a very, you know, they were very circumspect and that kind of thing. So it was, we had to build a lot of bridges there.
And were people, were gay men, say, over time in Columbus, maybe increasingly trustful of you?
Yeah, part of our thing, I hate to say it, part of our thing was outreach, you know, that we would go on and put on presentations to, you know.
Sure.
Here, I'm going to talk to the PTA about communicable disease, you know.
Right.
But our outreach in the gay community, even though that was, you know, basically, you know, in the closet,
yes.
there were three or four bars that they... Yeah, you know, that were known as gay bars and where they seemed to congregate.
This was in Columbus?
Yeah, and so we would just hang out there. And, you know, part of our job. Okay, let's work a couple nights. We'll just go down to the bar and talk to people. And, you know, when Joe puts his arm on your leg, his hand on your leg, hey, no, I'm not interested.
Right.
And, you know, and this is who I am. But I'd like to talk to you. And, you know, it's okay. And build up a trust that way. And, most of the time it was, successful, but
you know,
some of the time it wasn't.
Uh-huh. Mike, do you remember the names or locations of any of those bars?
Oh, there was one place called the Kismet. I have no idea. I can't remember where it was in Columbus.
Uh-huh.
And then there was another one, the Purple Pony or something like that.
Okay. And you sort of found out that these were gay bars how? From the police or
from my supervisor, the guy who was there were two of us, two recent college grads that were working Columbus, and had a fellow who cut his teeth in Detroit, and he was transferred out there, and he was like our manager.
Okay.
And he had been there, so he had identified those.
Okay.
And I'm sure he probably got some info from the vice squad, and,
right.
You know,
right.
or from contacts, you know, people that he's working with, you know, when he's working a case, hey, where do you hang out at? Okay,
yeah.
Hang out here. And, you know, usually once you would, and you know, these folks are grateful. I can remember one fellow was, I ended up finding this guy. He was named by someone, and then he had me, you know, and I worked with him for about a week, and you know, on and off, not full time. And then he, you know, he built the trust and a rapport, and then he would have us. Hey, would you talk to some of my friends? Sure, you know, love to, you know, about the disease. And hey, well, could you test me just to be sure? Okay, and then we'd educate him on the symptoms, and you know, say, hey, you know, if you notice, you know, any, you know, exhibit any symptomatology of, you know, the primary stage or secondary, you know, go get treated right away.
And so
once they found out we weren't there to beat their ass or, you know, or humiliate them, that they were, you know, that we were there to help them, we didn't have any problem.
And when you say you worked with this guy for a week or so, do you mean you just kind of had conversations with him off and on?
Yeah, to get him to open up and to, you know, to build a rapport with him so he could trust me that, you know, hey, I'm not going to call the cops on you. I'm not going to do anything. I'm just here to help you. I don't want to see you or any of your friends die, you know?
Right, and because there was a lot of suspicion, in the gay community about the potential for having the bars busted up or,
what these cops would do is they'd have lead-lined gloves. They would, you know, have little pouches sewed where their knuckles were, and they'd fill a little lead, you know, grains of lead or put things in there, and they'd just take them and slap guys upside the head with them.
Did you ever hear about had that actually happening?
I had a vice cop tell me that, and he told me, in fact, I was talking to a guy, he said, hey, because... They had certain areas where there was a lot of anonymous sex.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And he would tell me where those are, and then he would tell me what he would do when he'd pull in there a few times. And I just, okay. You know.
And you just kind of sat there listening to this going, what were you thinking?
Well, I'd just say how disgusting, you know, but, you know, I'm not gonna get this guy.
Right.
Against me, you know, I just say, yeah, well, you know, if you find that works, it works, I guess, you know, I just.
But you just wanted the information about where you could go.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
And was your supervisor encouraging of you making this kind of outreach to the gay?
Oh, yeah. He and I would do a lot of it together or, you know, what, because we knew that was the biggest obstacle to overcome. You know, was the suspicion in the gay community.
Right.
And then it got down to the point that, you know, once, you know, they got to know us in these bars, they were pretty truthful with us, you know, the bartenders or whatever. And, hey, you know, this is, you know, and they knew that we were there and, you know, treat you anonymously. All the records were treated very confidentially. And it wasn't, you know, there was no place. It was never indicated that you contacted it through, you know, the same sex encounter, you know, that, you know.
You weren't recording that they
were. No, not. We were just recording the fact that they were named as a contact by, you know, by someone. We couldn't even by law divulge who had named them.
Okay.
I mean, it was, I'm not sure if it was by law, but that was our working guideline that, that was treated extremely confidentially. You know, if somebody named you and you say, well, who named me? I'm sorry, I can't tell that to say that. You know, we have to go from here.
And no one ever had the sense that you were conducting any kind of witch hunt here, that this was a helpful thing that you were trying to do.
Right.
Okay. And were you proud of that work?
I liked it. It was helping people, you know, and it was, it was a terrible disease, and you know, untreated, it could have horrible outcomes. And for part of the problem, though, in communicating it, the horrible outcome might be 20 years from now, you know. But it would be there, and you know, our goal was to eradicate it.
How long did you do this?
Well, I did that for about a year.
Okay,
that was my first job out of college, and then that wasn't a deferable job. Okay,
with regard to the draft.
Right, and the draft was closing, and in fact, we were going to, as I said, I did everything possible to get out. we were originally going to get married on August 21st of 1965.
Mm-hmm.
And sometime late June or July, Johnson came out and said, anybody who was married before August 14th won't get drafted. So we pushed our date up to August 7th. So, but the invitations were printed, so we had to cross that out and change the date. And in fact, my wedding ring has August 7th and my wife's has August 21st because I bought hers first. And so we know why you're getting married. She's pregnant. Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
So we pushed our wedding date up, and I always thought if I could sue Johnson for breach of contract, but I never... Never
no,
could.
Never came. Never got that far.
Never did. So we did that, and it looked like I was going to get drafted, and so I said, well, we better pull up stakes out of Columbus and move back to South Bend, so at least Madeline could be by friends and family.
Madeline being your wife.
My wife, yeah.
Right, and she was from South Bend.
Yeah.
Yeah. What high school had she gone to?
South Bend Riley,
okay.
Southside.
Okay.
Southside of town. Yeah.
So your departure from the PHS / Ohio Department of Health was really driven by the imminence of draft.
Right, yeah.
So during 1965, when you were working for PHS, you were also paying a lot of attention to the war?
Mm-hmm. Well, not necessarily the war, the draft calls. They start changing this, and then they said, now we're going to take you regardless of your marital status, regardless of when you got married. So, and I figured it was just a matter of time, because back then they didn't even have the lottery.
Right, right. And you were, 22 years old?
I was born in 43, so I was 22 when I graduated. I was 23 when I got drafted. Yeah.
Did you ever consider enlisting so that you could avoid the draft? Because, a number of men that I've talked to have told me that they enlisted specifically because they thought they were going to be drafted and they wanted to get a better placement or something.
Well, I thought about it briefly, but I didn't want to do 4 years.
Okay.
I didn't want to do 4 years. And the reserve units and that stuff were almost impossible to get into.
Yes.
Unless you had a name of Bush or something,
okay.
Or a quail. So they were pretty hard to get into, and I just said, hey, I hope my wife can get pregnant, then I won't get drafted. we weren't practicing any kind of birth control anyway, she got pregnant, but we found out a month after I'm in the Army.
So you moved back to South Bend.
Yeah, and I took a job with Bendix Aerospace Division.
Okay, can you tell me about that job?
Well, I took a job as well, like in production control, and we were making basically carburetors and afterburners for what then was called the TFX, which turned out to be the F-111.
Right.
That was supposed to be the super duper latest kind of thing around.
Go ahead.
Well, I figured, gee, hey, I'm working for a defense contractor. Yes. I'm going to see if I can get a deferment. So I called the draft board. They said, no way.
Was that your motivation in seeking out a job at Bendix?
No, that was the first person, people that made an offer to me. I needed a job. So I floated some resumes and started interviewing. They were the first people to call me and made me an offer. And
when you say production control, what exactly does that mean?
What I did was I was in the engineering change control section that whenever the engineers made a change in the design, we would have to integrate that into the production system, make sure all the prints and paperwork were changed and that kind of thing.
And how did you kind of transition and talk your way into...
I didn't talk my way. I was just there. I think there was some labor shortages then, or unemployment was very low. So I just went out, and they said, "Why should we hire you?" I said, "Well, I'm a pretty smart guy. I can think, and okay." That was it. I never really had too much of a problem.
Did you like doing that work at Bendix?
No.
Why not?
I was kind of boring, it wasn't too much. I like interacting with people and stuff like that.
Yeah, and in that way it was quite different from the PHS job.
Yeah, it was kind of boring, and technical stuff like that never really interested me that well. So.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But, it, you know, it was a job, and the money was good at the time. It was about probably about $1,200 a year more than I was making with the government, and it was, you know, it was okay.
And you worked there for how long?
Until I got drafted. I had very brief, probably 6 months. Well,
okay.
Let's see, I probably went there in June, then I got drafted in, when did I go in? November, I think.
When did you receive your actual notice?
You know, I was thinking about that this morning. I thought you were going to ask me that. I don't know. I'm going to say maybe like a month ahead of time. So I was drafted in November, first part of November.
Of 1966.
66, yes, ma'am.
Okay.
And so I think I may have got it in October sometime, yeah. Because they gave us about a month to get our affairs together, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And how did you feel when you got that notice?
Well, like somebody kicked me in the guts, you know. Yeah. It's like, you know, geez, this is really great, you know.
Right.
Just what I want. But, you know, but then again it was, hey, my country's calling, I don't like it, but, you know, I wish I could get out of it, but, you know, this is what I got to do.
Did you think about both sides of that equation when it happened? You know, gee, this is awful, but on the other hand, I...
Well, personally, to me, it's awful. Yeah, I said, I hate to leave this. I was worried about my wife and all that. My mother, it would be pretty tough on her. And, you know, on a personal level, you know, I thought it was awful. But then on, I guess, an intellectual level, it says, hey, my country calls. They need me. I'm going to have to go.
How did your mom react?
She was sad. She was sad, you know, because now, you know, like when my brother went in the Marines, it was peacetime and all that. And it was, and I have to interject that, my brother, would write home sometimes and say, hey, did you see this guy on the news? You know, and I was in the service with him. But then my mother said, oh, yeah, I remember that. But then when Walter Cronkite, after he interviewed the guy, would say, oh, yeah, this guy was killed 3 days later or
right.
something. You know, and that
right.
was...
Things like that.
It was... So, you know, she knew there was probably going to be imminent harm, you know,
right.
and wanted her little baby to be safe, you
right.
know.
So she was very anxious.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And what about Madeline?
She was upset. I mean, you know, she it was like, oh, my God, you know, there we go.
Yeah. Yeah.
But again, you know, her dad and her stepfather were both, you know, World War II vets. And, you know, they knew that, in fact, her stepdad stayed in for, he got out just before the Korean War began. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, knew that it was, you know, I guess a rite of passage for manhood or something, you know, I don't know.
So she was not unfamiliar with the idea of military service?
Well, no, because you got to understand, back then, you know, you know, everybody, your uncles, everybody, your cousins, you know, older cousins, uncles, everybody had served, mm-hmm. either in World War II or in Korea. And, you know, so they were in. So it wasn't unusual. People knew it.
Was Madeline going to be working? Did she work?
Well, when we got married, she didn't work. When I got drafted, then she wrote me about a month later that she was pregnant. She had gotten a job at a, you got to understand, I got drafted, and E1 was making $90 a month,
okay.
of which they took, I want to say, $55 out of my pay, and they added $40 to it, and she got like a $95 a month allotment.
Okay.
And then we had a $65 a month car payment.
Car payment?
Yeah.
What car did you buy?
Well, I had to buy a car out of, when I graduated
uh-huh.
from school. I had a real nice car. Well, I shouldn't say nice car, but I had a pretty fast car when I was in college.
Uh-huh.
But with the government said get paid mileage, so I bought a 1965 Chevy Chevelle. Six-cylinder stick,
wow.
a good mileage and that. But so we had this, you know, we had the car payment. So she took a job with a company. They sold mimeograph machines.
Okay.
Back then we didn't have the Xeroxes like we do now. You
right.
know? And, but then she was pregnant, and that was back when, oh, gee, you're pregnant, we're going to can you, you know. But fortunately they didn't. They let her work part-time when she started showing.
Why do you think they kept her on when their policy was to...
Well, I don't think that was, I'm not sure if that was their policy, okay. But that was pretty much the general practice.
Kind
but they kept her out of, they kept her out of sight. But they kept her on because most of the guys, most of the salesmen, and I think the owner of the business, they were all vets.
Okay.
So, you know, they had a lot of empathy for,
right.
You know, for, geez, you're here by yourself and your husband's in the service and, you know, that
Stop.
Kind of stuff. So they're going to help you out.
Yeah. So you think, that you went in about November of 1960?
Yeah, it was November, because okay. I can remember my first Saturday in the reception center was the day that Notre Dame and Michigan State were both undefeated, and they played to that notorious 10-10 tie.
Right.
You know, Errol Parseghian. That was my first Saturday in a reception center, because I was peeling potatoes and complaining because they didn't have a radio and we couldn't listen to the
game.
Oh,
no.
Yeah. That's one of those significant
right.
events in life.
Well, that was the game of the century up there.
Yeah, right? Yeah. That's where Nick Eddy sprained his foot getting off the train going into East Lansing. But
so
anyway.
Who did you support?
Notre Dame.
Okay.
I grew up in South Bend. Yeah.
Well, I was hoping you'd say Michigan State, but okay.
Yeah. Michigan who?
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
So tell me about actually going to Fort Campbell. How did you go on bus?
Well, no, we had to report at the local armory.
Okay.
At, you know, and the army does these things at god awful early morning times.
Mm-hmm.
So we had just cleaned the day before. I think we put our stuff in storage. We didn't really have that much, and cleaned out the apartment. And we spent that night at my mother's house.
Was that where Madeline was going to live then?
No, she then went back with her folks.
With
her folks.
Okay.
And but we spent that night at my mom's house. And then my mom and aunt and Madeline drove me to the armory, and we had to be there like at 5 o'clock in the morning or something.
Uh-huh.
And there were a whole bunch of us. There was probably 200-300 people there. And they put us all on... buses, and they took us over to the Chicago Replacement Center, or Reception Center, or Induction Center, I guess they call it. And then we went through there, and we had a cursory physical, and I can't remember. I think we had some tests there, too.
Uh-huh. Can you describe the physical? What did they actually look for? Did they just do height and weight, or what did they do?
Well, let's put it this way. About half the guys that they passed on from there were rejected in the reception center when we got to Fort Campbell. So it was very cursory.
Okay.
You know, they, you know, open your mouth and, you know, look in your mouth, look in your ear.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, can you see the wall chart? Don't have to read the things. Can you see it? Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
I mean, it was like a meat market. And there were all of us from South Bend, and there were, you know, these buses coming from all over. So there was thousands of people there.
Yeah, it was just huge.
Yeah. And, so yeah, I remember a lot of waiting, not really much time, you know, doing anything.
Well, I was just going to ask, was there chatter going on where or was it a kind of nervous quietness? Or do you remember?
Well, we're just all talking. Everybody's kind of scared and apprehensive. And yeah. You're kind of talking, and you know, and you kind of stick with the guys that you know you sat around on the bus with, you know, and laugh at the guy who got you know wearing women's panties, thinking he can get out of it, and you know, stuff like that. Because
uh-huh.
You're all stripped to your underwear,
right.
You know, and going through this thing.
Right. And did that work?
I think the guy got smacked a couple times, and then he. They gave him some regular underwear.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. They weren't very nice.
Uh-huh.
You know, and then, well, yeah. I think they've seen it all. You
probably.
Know, they got kind of cynical. You know.
Probably.
And then yeah, I remember we got sworn in, and rather than saying I do, had to take the step forward.
Okay.
And then they asked for volunteers for the Marines. I think just for the Marines. I don't think they were taking any volunteers for the Navy.
And you did what?
I stayed where I was.
Didn't want to go in the Marines.
No.
Can you remember why you didn't want to go in the Marines?
No, it's just that, you know, my brother said, if you can avoid it, don't.
Okay.
You know, because he was in the infantry in the Marines for 4 years, well, for 3 years, and he was an instructor in hand-to-hand combat for a year, and he said, you probably don't want the Marine Corps. He knew me.
He knew
said, you're too soft, yeah, mm-hmm. You know.
Mm-hmm.
But I just said, you probably don't want the Marines.
What tests did they give you there?
I can't remember. I think they probably gave us the GATB. I'm not sure.
Okay, can you spell that?
Do you know the GAT, TBY. That was a general aptitude test battery.
Okay.
Which was very common in the 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. And I think they gave us the GATB, which looked at, you know, hand-eye coordination, you know, fine motor skills, some reasoning things. And then there were some pen and paper tests, but I can't remember it. Like it may be a general IQ test or something. It's, you know, it was something, it wasn't very significant.
Did you do the best you could on the test? Yeah, I did.
And then, well, they processed us through, and then we had to take our step forward. And, you know, and they swore us in.
Mm-hmm.
And then they herded us down. I can't remember if we rode a bus or walked to a railroad station.
Okay.
And then they put us on railroad cars and took us down to Fort Campbell.
And how long was that ride?
Well, it seems like we got on the train at like 4 or 5 that night. And they even made sleeping berths for us, you know. And then we got there early the next morning, I think. But I remember we were off on a siding for a while waiting for something, you know, maybe for another engine or something someplace
right.
in Indiana. But it was, you know, basically an overnight trip.
And you probably didn't sleep all that well?
Yeah, I slept pretty well.
Did
yeah.
you?
Yeah, I slept pretty well.
Okay.
And, well, there were a few of us because there were some real characters in a couple of the cars, and they were trying to go around robbing people. So a bunch of us were... You know, a few of us said, okay, we'll sleep and stay awake. And, you know, they come by this, you know, because they had some real bad guys from Chicago, or they thought they were bad from Chicago on
uh-huh.
there, and they're going to try to maximize something. But
uh-huh.
but they, you know, I think I was asleep before my turn, and a guy said that somebody tried to come in, but they persuaded him not to.
Okay. When you arrived at Fort Campbell, What were the first things that you saw?
Well, you know, we got off the train, and there, you know, people yelling at you, you know, get in line, do this, do that, and, you know, that kind of stuff. And you just kind of, you know, went with the herd.
Right. How did that military discipline affect you those first several days that you were at basic?
Well, the first thing we did, we went through the reception center. That's where they cut your hair off, and then we had a real detailed, close physical.
Okay.
And then a lot more testing.
Okay.
And then in the reception center, then they, as a result of that testing, then they gave you then you had an interview with somebody where they basically gave you your job.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
uh-huh.
And that's where I made mistake number one.
What was your mistake number one?
Well, they said, well, man, based on your test results and this and that, you should, yeah, we're going to make you a personnel specialist. Okay, that sounds good.
Uh-huh.
And they said, oh, yeah, and by the way, your OCS preference test is, you got a great score on that. Would you like to go OCS? I said, well, yeah, I might think about that. And they said, well, you know, when your OCS lasts 6 months and you're paid as a E5 while you're in OCS, oh, more money, I'll go.
Okay,
you know?
All that sounded good.
Yeah, all that sounded real good. And then I, you know, and then so I had to select a combat arm because I didn't have a physical profile, as they called. So I made my selection and then they routed us to a basic training company. You know, we had to carry, in reception center, you got all your gear, your shoes, your fatigues.
Right.
They measured you for your class A's. I can't remember if we got our class A at the same time or if that came later and all that stuff. And then I had a pretty heavy duffel bag that we had to run with to our company, you know, the basic training company.
Mm-hmm. And, the company that you were assigned to, was it, did you find out people who had done well in their tests, similar to?
No, we were all together. There were a lot of the people going through in our company. There were, see, back then you had a service prefix to your number.
Okay.
You had US, RA, NG, or ER.
Can you explain what those are?
US was you were drafted.
Okay.
RA, you enlisted. NG, you were National Guard, and ER, you were an enlisted reserve.
Okay.
So we had a lot of National Guard and reserve guys. So there were probably 200 maybe 220 people in our company, mm-hmm. and I think, and there were four platoons. I think our platoon was the only one that had what was just the U.S. and RA. I don't think there are any reservists. There may have been one or two in ours, but they were in all the other platoons.
And how did that kind of change the mix? People who had already had some experience with the military.
Well, they didn't really have any experience. You know, they just joined the service. They probably weren't even going to the meetings until they do their, you know, they supposedly had to do 6 months on active. But
okay.
they basically uh-huh. just had to do their basic and AIT, then they go back to their unit.
Back to their reserve unit.
Yeah.
Right. And, okay. But their expectations of what they were going to experience was... After basic.
Yeah, they kept a pretty low profile.
Yeah.
You know, they weren't bragging about, you know, that they're going to, you know, go home. I guess they didn't think they had to. You know, everybody knew they were lucky.
Right. Could you remember your DIs?
Yeah.
How did they treat you?
Good. Well, see, I had two sets of DIs because I got to my basic training unit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we were probably a week or two into the unit, the end of the cycle, and it got colder than heck, and a whole bunch of us got sick.
Oh, really?
Got the flu, or so there was a flu epidemic going by, and they had this, so we go on sick call, and if you had a temperature above a certain point, they'd put you in the hospital.
Uh-huh.
So I was pretty sick. I had a high temperature, so they put me in a hospital. That was going to be a couple days stint, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But while I was in a hospital, they do all this testing, and they found out that I was passing a lot of sugar in my urine.
Okay.
So here they thought, maybe he's diabetic.
Yeah.
So they kept me in the hospital. Now, so let's say this is from mid-November. They kept me in the hospital through Christmas. Now, they gave me convalescent leave. I got to go home at Christmas time for a week or two.
Wow.
And because basically the whole base shut down at Christmas time.
Right.
Everybody got home. And then they finally decided I wasn't diabetic. So then by that time, the group I was with, I was pretty much done with basic.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they assigned me to another, then they decided I wasn't diabetic after doing, oh gosh, I think they must have did 8 or 10 glucose tolerance tests over a period of time.
Uh-huh.
And this is back where, you know, they give you this, like a quart of real sugar water to drink. And they take your blood sample before you drink it. And then they take it like every half hour for 3 hours or something like
right.
that after you drink it to, you know, to test.
Right.
I know all my veins were collapsing.
Yeah.
They were hitting me so much. And they finally decided that they said I had renal glyceria, which just basically means my kidneys don't retain the sugar like it should, just
uh-huh.
passes it, but it's, you know, it's not life threatening and that's just the condition and, you know, you're normal. So it probably took them about 6 weeks to figure that out.
And who, when you were in the hospital, who was taking care of you? Was it corpsmen or?
Yeah,
or
yeah. Basically, I had some corpsmen, and there were some nurse officers, but most of the guys were medics, corpsmen, you know, hospital attendants, that kind of thing.
We were
in a big ward. Yeah.
Right. Did any of them talk to you about Vietnam? Some of them may have already.
Well, a few of the guys in the ward were coming back from Vietnam.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, and they were a couple, or they had been there, and then I know this one fellow was there, because see, Fort Campbell was the home of the 101st.
The 101st Airborne. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and I think at that time, I'm not sure if there was a brigade of the 101st in Nam or not. I think there probably was. I'm
uh-huh.
not sure. But we had a couple guys that were special forces that were in the ward. They were having relapses of malaria,
okay.
and that. So they were back, and I'm not sure if they were medevac back or they had already come back, and you know they were airborne qualified, so they're you know assigned 101st, and they have a relapse, and they put them in the hospital. So there are a couple of those guys around.
Mm-hmm. Did you talk to any of those
guys? Yeah, yeah. You know,
did they tell you some stories?
Yeah, you know, it was pretty upbeat, you know, it was,
uh-huh.
you know, yeah, they wouldn't talk about, you know, really hitting a crap
right.
as much as, you know, some of the funny things that happened
sure.
and how this guy said, hey, I got my 2 mile running every damn day over there, you know, oh, wow, it's 2 miles. I don't think I can do a mile or an hour, pal. And then I ran into a cousin of mine there.
Was that right?
Yeah, he was a kid from South Bend. He grew up and he was in an airborne unit in Germany, and he and his family were just getting ready to move back to the States, and on his last jump he landed in a potato field and busted his ankle. So his wife and kids came back by ship, and I guess they flew him back, and he was going to be stationed at Fort Campbell, so they put him in a hospital there. So I ran into him.
That was kind of strange.
I was just going down the hall, and you see this guy in crutches. I said, gee, he looks at me, I look at him, and I said, I think I know you, and he says, I know you. And we got together, so that was kind of fun. Yeah.
So the time in the hospital, did it go fairly quickly for you?
No, it drug. Okay. I mean, it didn't have any TV, and of course, no, not too many people had TV. It did read a lot, but
yeah.
You know, it's just kind of boring, just laying there, and you're feeling good, and you're antsy, and you want to get up and get about your life, and they won't let you.
What kinds of things were you reading? Do you remember?
Anything that they had. They'd come by with a cart, you know, a couple times a week. So I'd take two or three off of there that I hadn't read, from science fiction to, you know, novels. A lot of the stuff was old, you know.
And when they let you out for Christmas,
mm-hmm.
How was it to go back and see your wife and your family?
Oh, it was great. It was great. Said by that time, now I knew she was pregnant,
right.
And so it was great. I was glad I had the opportunity.
Sure.
You know, it really made me feel good.
Were they concerned that you had been in the hospital all this time?
No, they were kind of glad.
Okay.
Hey, that's, you know, I mean, it all counts against 2 years. You know,
had you been writing to them and telling them? Look,
oh yeah, yeah, we wrote regularly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you told them, look, I don't feel anything wrong, so.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
I did basically explain what was, you know, I'm in the hospital because I, you know, I had the flu and had a high fever, and they found this thing out, and they're just checking it out, but I feel, you know, feel great.
Was it tough to then report back after Christmas?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it always was. Yeah.
Where did you have to go?
What do you mean?
When your Christmas leave was up, did you have to return to the
Went back to the hospital. Had to report back to the hospital.
The hospital itself.
Yeah.
Okay. And,
yeah. And then shortly thereafter, then they assigned me to another basic training unit.
And so you basically had to start your training all over again.
Yeah.
Okay. And can you tell me about how the training went? Was it tough for you?
No, it was the toughest part was you know, some of the physical stuff,
right.
Because you know, here I had, you know, a month and a half or almost 2 months of sedentary kinds of things, and we would run get up in the morning and run about a mile before breakfast, and then eat breakfast, and then go out and do the, you probably heard it in your other interviews, do the daily dozen.
Right. Can you just explain what that is, though?
There's like 12 exercises that you do,
mm-hmm.
And that's how they get the dozen. And you do X number of repetitions. You're all in big rows, and they have a drill sergeant up on a podium leading you. And we had this one guy lead us in PT, and he'd have this a big chopping block up there, big like hunk of wood, and he had a great big sword, and he would whack that with the sword. He'd say, you know what that is? And if you were trained, you'd say, yeah, that's Charlie cutting our balls off because we're weak. You know, and then we'd have to, you know, okay, well, now what do you have to do to be strong? Exercise, drill sergeant. And we'd go through our daily dozen there. You know, they would like sit-ups, like, what, 8 or 12 count push-ups, you know, where you start. You know, standing and end standing,
yeah.
You know, where you kind of squat and then kick out and do the push-ups and
right.
Then come back up and that kind of stuff. So we do that. And then and usually if you're going out to a class or a range or something, you'd run, you know, to where you're going. And then lunch, you usually run a mile, and then you'd run to your classes again and that stuff, or walk. And if it's a long way away, you'd half run, half walk, you know, run part of the way, walk. And then at night you'd do about a mile before dinner, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So after, you know, a week or so, you get pretty acclimated to it.
Had any of the drill instructors or the man with the sword up on the
tower? Yeah, he was in Vietnam. About half of them were.
Is that right? Okay.
Yeah, half of them were.
Okay. And were they kind of reinforcing almost all the time the idea that you were going to Vietnam? And
no, not really. And I know we had this one guy, and he was a drill instructor, but he didn't go through drill instructor school. See, the guys that went through drill instructor school got to wear the almost Smokey the Bear hat.
Right.
And he just wore a helmet liner. He was in the, 173rd Airborne Brigade over there. And he was he was a sergeant first class, Sergeant St. Clair. He was from New York State, and he was, he had some physical problems because of Vietnam, and some severe wounds and that. And he was a nice guy, great guy.
Uh-huh.
And they'd just say, hey, don't worry about it. That's why, you're gonna, a good soldier is one who's trained, do your training well, and, they'll take care of it for you. And, really supportive, that kind of thing. The guys that were really on you were the guys who weren't over there,
Is that right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And some of them were really, it's not some of my favorite people, but,
right. And given that you did not want to be there, how was your attitude during this training?
Hey, got no choice. Might as well do it, It's just hurry up and wait, and I'll play their game.
Right.
Yeah. You kind of put your intelligence on hold,
Yes.
Just say, here I am, okay, I'll do it. And a lot of it was good, a lot of it was fun training,
Okay.
It was a lot of it was fun. We spent a lot of time, close order drill was kind of ridiculous, but we spent a lot of time doing that. We spent a lot of time, bayonet practice, and it's kind of funny because I think I lost my bayonet the second week in Vietnam and never got it replaced. And a lot of hand-to-hand combat, training and rifle training, and that was, it was kind of interesting.
Yeah. What about the weapons training? What weapons did they?
Well, I went through basic, just the M14.
Okay.
I just had the M14.
Okay.
And that's what we trained with, and that's what we qualified with.
Okay. When basic was coming to its conclusion, did you receive orders for advance?
Well, yeah. Now, what happened during basic? Remember, I said I made the mistake of the OCS deal.
Yes.
Okay. Well, then in the hospital, I had a lot of time to think, and my wife, and the original decision was motivated by money. Okay.
Right.
So when I was in the hospital, and through corresponding with Madeline, we decided that hey, the money's not the issue. We can make it for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, okay, so when I got to my training unit, I thought I had dropped OCS, because I went in, to the company commander and said, hey, I, signed up for it, but I don't want to go.
Right.
I changed my mind. I don't want to do that. Thinking that I would get the, back to be the personnel clerk.
Right.
And so then we got out of basic, and now I get orders for a pre-OCS AIT and field artillery at Fort Sill. And I said, well, hey, I don't want to go to OCS. He said, nothing we can do about it here. You got to do it down there. So,
okay, you've got to get out of it down.
Yeah.
At Fort Sill.
So, uh-huh. So I got the orders, and I think we had to stick around Fort Campbell for 3-4 days before transportation came, and they had a plane to come in, and we flew into Fort Sill,
uh-huh.
And we got there at night, and they put us in this barracks, and the next morning somebody's in my face screaming to get up, and it was a pre-OCS AIT, and these guys are, acting like they're an OCS and harassing you. And, so right after breakfast, I went to company commander and said, hey, I made a mistake here, pal. I dropped it. My intent was to drop it in basic training, but apparently the paperwork wasn't initiated. So I said, hey, no problem. And,
he said, no problem.
No, he said, no problem. Okay, here you go. It's told the, whoever it was, the first sergeant or whoever, he cut orders for this guy to, just go to regular training. So they sent me across the parade ground to a different company, which was training in the same discipline, field artillery operations and intelligence.
Were you surprised that it was that easy to kind of circumvent, or was that what
you I figured if I didn't want to be there, they probably didn't want me.
Okay.
And I'm sure they probably looked at this, looked at me and said, hey, here's a guy who's gonna, he's gonna milk the system, and he'll probably drop OCS, you know, 5 months into the process, so
right.
He has over a year in the Army, so he probably won't get cut to go to Vietnam. So, you know, a lot of people were doing that, so. You know.
Kind of better now than later, sort of thing,
yeah,
for them.
Yeah. So, you know, if you don't want to be there, we don't want you. I guess that was the attitude they had.
How did you feel about the artillery assignment?
Well, I said, well, they ain't the personnel clerk, is it?
That's right.
Oh, well.
That's right.
Okay. But that was just, well, that was okay. It was fun. It was academically challenging. You know, it's a, I'd worked with a surveyor, so, you know, I could read compasses and I could read maps and I, you know, basically knew, you know, where I was. I knew elevations, you know, things like that, which was, yeah, it was a piece of cake for me.
Can you talk about the training? What kind of academic stuff did they actually want you to master?
Well, basically, you know, how to read a map, how to read a compass, you know, like how to read, you know, topographical maps,
yes.
You know, and the contour lines and what they mean. And, you know, between working with a surveyor, and I had a 5-hour geology course in college as a science requirement, that was, you know, I knew it, you know, it was neat.
Right.
And then the, you know, the whole artillery thing is, you know, it's basically mathematic based, and math was never my strong suit in school, but, you know, I kind of liked it. It was, you know, the MOS that I trained in was, you had two roles. You either worked in a forward observer party calling in artillery, or you worked in an FDC center, fire direction control center, telling the guns, you know, translating their request for a fire mission. You know, you had to locate it geographically and then determine the firing data that's needed, you know, to determine the deflection and quadrant that the guns had to have to shoot to hopefully land on that target.
Right.
So that was, you know, that was kind of interesting.
So the math was not too difficult for you?
No, uh-uh.
Okay. It just wasn't your favorite thing.
Well, math was never my favorite thing in college, but this was, you know, this was pretty easy stuff. You know, about the hardest was how to adjust your data with meteorological data, you know,
okay.
To do a map, because, you know, a certain humidity level or a certain wind would affect the fall of shot.
Mm-hmm.
But,
and how
but
long,
you,
I'm sorry. Okay.
No.
I was just going to ask, how long did the advanced training program actually last?
2 months. It was just 2 months.
Okay, that's fast.
Yeah.
Did they give you any additional weapons training?
No, we didn't do anything there.
Okay.
No, it was based on the weapons we had. We were just on the range calling in fire and, you know,
okay.
And then plotting, you know, doing the exercises, doing, you know, telling the guns what their data was, as well as observing and adjusting fire.
And were the other guys in the artillery AIT also pretty bright guys that you could, you know, kind of relate to?
You had a pretty good mix,
okay.
You know.
Uh-huh.
Most of them, I would say probably in my training unit, I would say 90% of them were reservists and National Guard guys. The other guys, the draftees and that were, you know, I don't think it was a quote special unquote kind of training, although I think maybe, you know, maybe the and I got there by chance, obviously, because that's what the, you know, if you were pre-OCS, that's what you were trained in before you went to OCS.
Right.
And I don't know the criteria they used for, you know, if, you know, for the guy coming through, but you had to have, I would think you had to, would have to have a certain level of intelligence to do it, but,
right. Mike, can you just, walk me through a typical day there in AIT?
Okay. Yeah, we would, you know, we'd get up in the morning and, do our daily dozen. It was, these barracks were around like a square, you know, I mean, it had a square bounded on four sides by roads. And we'd do, you know, we'd run around the square probably equal a mile. We'd run and do our exercises and then eat breakfast. And then we were either out in the at the range, adjusting fire or computing the thing. Well, later, but at the beginning we were in class learning out all that stuff, you know.
Uh-huh.
And
right.
And then we were, you know, applying it, and we'd get then come back for lunch, go back to class or the range, come back about, I don't know, 4:30. We'd run around, we'd do our mile, and then eat dinner, and then we were done. You know, didn't have homework, and we'd go down to there's a little beer hall down the street. We'd go there and drink beer and get blasted, and we'll stagger back about 11, 12 o'clock, and
uh-huh.
you know, get up again the next morning at 5 and do it again.
So there was no problem with getting access to beer? And
no. They had the little, we call them beer halls, but they were a little like, I guess you call them C stores here in the States now, but they're just a little hut. They had big coolers of beer, and you could buy, you know, shaving cream and, you know, razor blades and, you know, a few of the sundries like that. And, and then they had, you know, coolers of beer, and it was, you know, if it was right after payday, we drank Coors for, I think it was 25 cents a quart.
Wow.
And if it was close to payday and we were stretching it, I think we drink Bush or Old Milwaukee for 10 cents a quart. So that was.
You were.
We drank a lot of quarts.
A lot of quarts.
Yeah. And they had picnic tables outside, so we'd sit around the picnic table and
drink
beer and talk and, you know, just.
Were the other guys primarily younger than you were?
Yeah, pretty much.
Were you like the old married man in the group? Or were there other guys who were married?
I'm not sure if I was. Well, see, a lot of the guys were, as I said, in the unit were, you know, Reserve and National Guard.
Okay.
And a lot of those guys were married. But of the enlisted or drafted guys, I think I was the only guy that was married. There may have been one other person married.
Did you find yourself kind of, I don't know, treating the experience a little bit differently because you were married, because you had a child on the way?
Yeah, it's just a big game to me.
Right, that you needed to survive. But,
yeah, exactly.
Right.
And,
go ahead.
Oh, no, and it was, but you developed a pretty good camaraderie with, you know, with the guys. It wasn't, you know, I wasn't pop like in the old World War II movies.
Right.
In Vietnam, I think I was, but not there.
Right. I think that you mentioned in the questionnaire that before you actually left for Vietnam, you also had some culture training about.
Oh, yeah. That now I'll continue the story.
Sure.
Though. I got out of AIT, and there was only one guy that had orders for Vietnam out of AIT,
okay.
And he had volunteered for it.
I see.
This is of the of the non National Guard enlist reserve guys. I had orders for Germany. And, but I didn't want to go to Germany because, I know I sound like I was a very picky soldier, but, you know, Madeline here is pregnant.
Yeah.
And I wanted to stay stateside until she had the baby because I was only, I think at that time I was an E3 now. I think I made private first class in AIT. And they wouldn't pay to, you know, move Madeline. She couldn't go with me.
Right.
It would be only, you had to be an E4 with over, I think, 4 years or 2 years of service or an E5. So I requested a delay in orders, until she had the baby.
Where were you supposed to go in Germany? Do you remember?
I have no idea. I just had some, orders to report to some, you know, replacement depot in Germany.
Okay.
I would presume it was to an artillery unit, but, I don't know. And so I had to, they said, oh, hey, no problem. They'd bring in a doctor statement.
Okay.
And so I had Madeline send me a note from her doctor. And then we graduated from AIT. Everybody went on their merry way. And then I was assigned to a holding company at Fort Sill.
Okay. When did you actually graduate from AIT? Do you remember the month?
I'd just say May or June.
So you went to a holding company.
Yeah.
Can you just describe what that is?
Well, it's just people like me who have, who have reasons. That, and I think there was a couple of us there waiting for our wives to have babies. There were a few people that, they didn't know what to do with them. You know, they had, you know, maybe a couple of months left in the Army, and they didn't want them to, in a, and they just came back from someplace. Not, nobody was, came back from Vietnam, but, you know, may, people may have been, their tour in Germany was over or something, so they came back, or they were on a medical hold. You know, they usually, a lot of these medical holds were guys that thought they shouldn't be in the service, and the Army said they should be, but their daddy wrote the congressman, and they have a congressional inquiry pending, and,
okay,
you know, that kind of thing. So it was kind of miscellaneous riffraff, you know, so that's what we called ourselves.
Did you actually know of a couple of guys there who were
I never knew what happened to them, but they were there.
But that was going on. So what, what did you do while you were in a holding company?
I guarded a laundromat. Well, they had various jobs to do around, and there, this laundromat was prime duty because it was open 18 hours a day.
Yeah.
And they had you had a 3-hour shift. I mean, sorry, you had a 6-hour shift, but it was right across the street from the base library.
Ooh.
So I said, man, hey, I'm going to get paid to read books, and all we had to do was just sit in the library and make sure nobody, if they felt the washer wasn't working and they couldn't get their money back, that they wouldn't be kicking on it or whatever. And you know, I never had any incident there, so I just I would before my tour at the laundromat, I would go into the I would go into the library, get a good book, and come back and sit there and read the book and turn it back in when I'm done, and you know, go get something to eat and then do the same thing next day. You know, the only thing was our shift rotated, like the, like, you know, I might be first shift today, then second shift tomorrow,
right,
then third shift the following day.
So,
then I think I had a day off and then just started over again.
So what were you reading, Mike?
Everything. You know, I read a lot of Hemingway, Fitzgerald, histories. I think I read the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. Just everything. You know,
did
just,
you pick up anything on Asia or Southeast
Asia?
Did you?
Nope.
Was that kind of by just, I'm not there, so I don't have to.
No, I was going to Germany, remember?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you thought you still thought while you were in the holding company that the orders for Germany were
I thought they were just suspended. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So did you read some German history or anything about the Third Reich?
No, I read a biography on I read the Decline. Shires, the Rise and Fall of the Third Reich.
Right. Okay.
And I think I read a biography of Frederick Barbarossa, and
okay,
I think I read something on. Oh, geez, who the Iron Chancellor? Bismarck. And I read, I can't remember if it was out then or not. I don't know. It just a bunch of stuff. You
so
know,
you were,
I, well,
you were,
I wasn't picking any particular thing, just
right,
trying to stay, you know, past the time.
Right. And so when was your child born then?
July 20th of 1967.
And did all that go okay?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. In fact, I came back from the laundromat one day, and there was a note on my bunk that said, call your brother. So I called my brother, and he said, hey, congratulations, you're a daddy. Oh, great, so I'm going to come home. So I requested leave and went home.
Yeah.
I think I got there, I can't remember what day he was born on. I think I got there 2 days later.
So this is your son?
Yeah.
And how long were you able to stay?
I would say it was about 2 weeks, maybe, you know, maybe a little longer, maybe 18 days. Yeah.
And when you returned, so this would be sometime maybe the first or second week of August, when you returned, you had to go back to Fort Sill.
Yeah, I went back to the holding company. That was my unit.
Okay.
And I signed in, you know, in the Army, your leave is up at midnight, you know, so everybody waits till, you know, like 5 minutes of midnight before they come in and sign in. So
right,
it was about 5 minutes to midnight, I signed in, and the charge of quarters said, hey, first sergeant wants to see you in the morning. Oh, okay, great.
Mm-hmm.
I said, at this time, I said, I'm hoping I get the laundromat back.
Sure, yeah.
It was good duty, and so I go see him in the morning, and he said, guess what, McGregor? I said, what's that? He said, we put you on a levy. I said, oh, shit. Okay, that was a levy to Vietnam. And, you know, basically what would happen is, you know, the guys getting out of training, I guess, would get their orders to Vietnam, and then if they needed anything more, then they levied the various army bases around the country by MOS. They'd say, okay, we need so many people with this specialty, and okay, Fort Sill, you've got to fill 25% of the thing, and then they'd look around for available people, and if, you know, I was perfect to get because I didn't have a permanent unit, and that saved somebody who was in a regular unit from, you know, they're having to ship them out.
Right,
so.
Going short. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you were sitting there in a holding company, and you were just ripe pickings.
Yep. Yeah, I was, yeah. So I said, how about Germany? They said, how about it? Okay.
They weren't persuaded by your appeal that you should be going to Germany.
Oh, no, no. And I knew it. You know, I figured, you know, once he said levy, I mean, you know, you can, you know, hey, that's fate, you know.
You had learned about this levying system kind of.
Yeah, yeah. They had people, you know, they'd talk about, you know, levies and, you know, through this, you know, I got to know, it's a laundromat, I got to know a bunch of guys, they'd come and do their laundry or, and that kind of stuff, and they would, you know, they'd talk about a levy, or, hey, you know, Joe's got, you know, he won, you know, he's on a levy, he's going, and, okay.
What was that like, Mike, to come back from just having, you know, been with your wife and your child, seeing the child for the first time, and all that, you know, excitement and probably euphoria?
Yeah.
And then you come back, and the first morning that you're back in, you not only get ship out news, but ship out news for Vietnam.
It was one of those oh shit moments of life, you know. What else can you say?
Right.
You know, I said, oh, I was disappointed, shocked,
yeah.
You know, a little worried,
yeah.
That whole kind of thing. But then, before you went, then you had to do what you referred to earlier. We had to do the RVN training, the Vietnam training.
Okay.
Where they ran us through, you know, we had to write a will, which was an uplifting experience.
I'll bet.
But you know, hey, the Army was taking care of us. They wanted to make sure everything was covered, you know, and, then we had a few days. Well, then I had to qualify with the M16 then. Because,
okay.
So I spent, you know, maybe a couple days familiarizing myself and then at the range shooting, which was, you know, it was kind of fun.
How easily did the, target shooting come to you?
Oh, great, good. Because
yeah.
I'd hunted a lot as a kid and
right?
shot a lot. And, you know, I had cousins and uncles that take my brother and I out hunting, and, you know, I had a shotgun. I had a rifle, I think, when I was 9, 10 years old, you know, 22. And so, you know, I like shooting anyway, and I didn't think the M16 was much of a rifle after the M14.
Yeah,
you know?
I was going to ask you, how did you get along with the M16?
Oh, it was nice. I mean, you know, it's a lot lighter to carry, you know.
Right.
And I thought it was an interesting weapon. And so we had to do that. Then we had classes on, you know, Vietnamese culture and, you know, some of the words. And then we had our doctor talk to us about, you know, genital wounds may look like they're terrible, but don't worry, you know, you can still function. And, you know,
yeah.
I mean, it was unbelievable.
Right, you're getting the idea.
What is it? And I think they just want to
relieve
your fears
sure.
and that. And then there was a, then we had to practice convoying, riding in a convoy and breaking ambushes. So we'd be in trucks, and then we'd get someplace, and something would blow up in front of us, and the trucks would stop, and people would be shooting at us from the sides, and
right.
we'd have to run off the truck and shoot back at them and try to break the ambush. We did that, two or three times, and then they had a Vietnamese village built, believe it or not, in the plains of Fort Sill, Oklahoma,
uh-huh.
and then, you know, we had... you know, some orientation on booby traps and how to search a village and,
right.
You know, tunnels. But, you know, being 6'4 and, you know,
yeah.
at that time about 225, I said, well, you're never going to go in one of these tunnels. I said, yep, I know. That's why I'm big.
Right.
And, and did that. And I thought it was all pretty interesting training.
Was it useful to you, or did you feel like, gosh, I'm an artilleryman. I don't need to know this?
Well, but see, you know, we were, in the back of my mind, I figured I was going to direct support unit, which meant that I'd probably be in an FO party anyway. So it was anything. I figured anything I can learn, and I go back to Sergeant St. Clair in basic training, saying, "Hey, this training is all for you. You know,
right.
You guys soak it up,
right.
Learn from it because it'll keep you alive." So I was a pretty attentive student.
Okay. And was the culture, and you said a little bit of language training there. Can you describe that? What did they try to get across to you?
Well, basically, that, you know, don't laugh at them. If you see guys walking around holding each other's hands, they're not gay. You know, that's just a sign of, you know, to show friendship between two guys. You know, and about the that some of them are Catholics and some of them are Buddhists, and the Buddhists may, you know, and then, you know, try to understand that, you know, you don't want to, if you see a monk, don't offer him a hamburger or something, you know,
right.
I mean, really basic stuff,
right.
Like that, yeah.
Was it essentially, do you think, to give you a few kind of survival hints, or was it more about sort of respect?
Well, mostly I think about respect and just understand that these folks are different. And, you know, like they said, they use human waste as fertilizer. So, if the rice paddy smells like crap, it probably is. But that's normal.
Right.
Don't worry about it, you know, and that stuff. But,
And what about the language? Do you remember what kinds of words they were trying to get you to?
Well, basically, just how to pronounce some of the South Vietnamese Army ranks, like Dawi and... And then some of the really easy stuff like water and,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's about all I can remember.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you end up using that language?
No. I mean, we over there we'd call it, you know, a little nook, you know, which is water. But, I didn't really interact that much with the civilian population wise there, just a few times right at first.
Okay. And how long did this this kind of special training with the ambush and the village and the culture training and all that, how long did that last?
I would say probably a week, maybe 10 days, a week or 2 weeks. Wasn't very long.
And overall, do you think that was a good idea that the military tried to give you some of those?
I appreciated it, you know, at least. And you know, and they talked a little about, you know, operations and how they do things, and you know, the chain of command, and you know, like Vietnam's not the end of the world, and,
right.
you know, that kind of stuff.
Right.
So,
and
it was okay.
At the end of that training, did you feel like you were as ready as you were ever going to be?
I figure I had a good start, yeah.
Okay.
I didn't know if I didn't know what I was getting into, so
right.
I didn't really know if I was that ready or not. And then I got orders for the 15th, we got orders to report to the 15th Admin Company, which is the first aircraft. And then the guys there, so I thought, what's this? They can make me a clerk? Nope, that's just where all the replacements go, to the first cab. Oh, okay. So then I knew where I was going.
In the first cab?
Yeah.
Right. Okay, Mike, do you want to take a break for just a moment?
Oh, yeah, I can't. What time is it? Okay.
Okay, Mike, so we've finished with your sort of special training on Vietnamese culture and
mm-hmm.
some of the tactics, and you've received your orders to first cab. Can you tell us what happened next? How did you...
Well, then I got a leave. I think it was a non-chargeable leave. I believe it was, because I was paid more leave than I had on the books when I got out of the Army. So, and I went home again for, maybe 20 days, 25 days or something like that.
So that was quite a good long leave.
Yeah, it was nice, yeah. So I went home, and the only thing I can remember about that, and Madeline was there, and obviously the little baby was there.
Right.
In her mom's house, and I can remember, the only thing I can remember is that we had a big wash tub in the backyard, and we're dyeing all my white underwear green. That's what I can remember, because they said, you better have green underwear over there. I don't want to see a white shirt. Okay, so I'm going to do that.
When your leave was expiring, how did you feel?
Well, this is it. See you in a year.
Okay.
You know, I told Madeline, I said, don't worry, I'll be back. I'll come home. One way or another, I'll come home. And I just told my mother the same thing. And she she said, well, you better, because I lost one man, and I don't want to lose another one.
Right.
So, okay.
Right.
And it was kind of a sad feeling, you know, going over, leaving. And
right.
Then I left from, then went from South Bend to San Francisco.
Okay, and were you supposed to report at San Francisco?
Yeah, I was a report at the Oakland repo depot, the
okay.
replacement depot. And I should say there's another guy in the holding company and I went through this thing together, Charlie Poore.
How do you spell his last name? Do you remember?
P-O-O-R-E.
Okay.
Charlie. He's from Wichita. Was from Wichita Falls, Texas,
uh-huh.
over in your neighborhood. But he was in a holding company with me, same MOS. And we had both had orders for the calves. So I met up with Charlie, and we went on leave together, and then we met at the Oakland replacement depot. And I think we were only there, I don't know, maybe 3-4 days. And it was kind of an open post, and they had you just had to go make a formation maybe 3, maybe 4 times a day where they called the names off of the guys that were shipping out. And then you just kind of hung around, and they had a club, you can drink some beer, and you know that kind
right.
of thing.
Right.
And I think that was my first exposure to protesters. There were some people out there, because between the area where you had your formation and the bar,
mm-hmm.
the enlisted men's club was a street, and there were some people on the street with signs, but they didn't bother us. We didn't bother them.
What do you remember? What the tenor of their signs was?
Not something like "Stop the War" or "Don't Go" or you know something like that.
And were
that.
They old or young or white or black?
I can't remember. You know, I really don't remember. And you know, I just remember looking at the sign and telling Charlie we're walking over there for a beer. I said, "Yeah, I wish to hell I wouldn't have to go." You know, I was,
right.
Do they have the magic thing? You know, and
right.
just didn't. You know, that was it. You know, and so.
you were actually kind of in simpatico with them. With the protesters, yeah, let's stop the war.
Yeah, oh hell yes. I don't care. You know,
did you have a general sense, or had the Army given you training as to why the United States was actually committing to?
Well, yeah, this was part of that, you know, the stuff at Fort Sill, that you know about the communists are trying to take this place over, and they're killing all these people, and they're you know anybody that's for the government, they're coming by, you know, disemboweling them, and you know
okay, so
doing
told,
that kind of stuff.
So that was part of your training, was you were being told that the communists.
We were
Vietnam,
told about the atrocities that they
uh-huh.
were doing, yeah,
uh-huh.
you know, and they were, and you know, the VC was a very nasty bunch of guys,
right?
You know.
What was your reaction to that training? Was this new to you? Had you known?
Yeah, some of that stuff was in the papers, you know. They'd say about a village getting this and that. I wouldn't really pay much attention to it. And then
right.
they were talking about, you know, this is a, and I think they went a little on the, I can't remember if they talked about when the what happened to Vietnam after the French were there or not, but
uh-huh.
how they, you know, how they're coming in and they want to discredit their government and they're fighting this and, you know.
Yeah.
I couldn't, you know. They didn't really dwell on it as I recall, but,
uh-huh.
you know, the information was presented.
As a, you're a trained historian, basically. Did you, believe everything they were telling you?
Pretty much so.
Uh-huh.
My government never lies to me. Other than Johnson about getting drafted.
Right. Well, there was.
You got to remember, I grew up. Government was good.
Okay.
You know, you believe what these guys are telling you. You know?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Let's go back to Oakland just for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
What was the mood there? Do you remember what were guys kind of chatting about?
Everything but going to Vietnam,
okay.
you know, it kind of avoided the subject. I remember, there was one guy there, I think he was going to the cab too, but I can't remember what his job was, but he was coming out of the, I think it was the 82nd Airborne, and he had been deployed like the year before to when we went into the Dominican Republic.
Yes.
He was there and, you know, he was telling us, he spent a lot of time telling us about stuff in the Dominican Republic and, you know, going in there and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Which was kind of interesting.
Right.
But,
did you have any opinion about the United States actions that he told you about?
I knew we went in there. I had no idea why.
Uh-huh.
But I from studying history, I knew our involvement in the islands in Haiti and Central America through the Banana Wars, and my brother told me all kinds of stuff about what the Marines did, because that apparently when he was in the Marines, they really indoctrinated him with the history of the Corps and what all they did in Nicaragua and Haiti and all that kind of stuff.
Did you feel a great deal of apprehension at this point about getting on a plane and going over to Vietnam?
I was scared, yeah. I was scared. I mean, you're facing it wasn't an unknown that you looked forward with bated breath, it's not like, gee, hey, I'm going to Disney World for the first time, and man, I wonder what I'm going to encounter, more like, I'm going to Gary, Indiana, and what the hell am I going to encounter, it's terrible, it was the apprehension and, the fear of the unknown, I guess,
Yeah, and did you find out what time and what day you were going to actually embark by them calling out your name?
Well, yeah, basically what happened, they call your name out, you go back, get your duffel bag, you report an hour later, you're on a bus, you go over to Travis Air Force Base, you get on an airplane and fly over.
Okay. What kind of plane did you actually get on,
I think it was a 707. It was a charter from Flying Tiger, I think. I'm not sure.
Uh-huh. And what was your route, do you remember?
We left the Bay Area at nighttime, about 10 o'clock. And I'll never forget this, that we were flying over, and I don't know if it's the Bay Bridge or the Golden Gate, but, we could see that, and I think they put on a sound system. They played I Left My Heart in San Francisco.
Did they really?
Tony Bennett, yeah. Everybody got a big laugh out of that. And then we landed in Hawaii, in Honolulu International, in the morning, a.m. I think the doors to the airport, this back before security and stuff, you just get off the ramp and walk in. It was open, but there may have been one shop or a snack bar or something that was open there, but that was it. We were there about, I'd say maybe an hour, hour and a half, is enough time to refuel, and took off again. And in the morning, sometime in the morning, it may have been the morning of the next day, but I remember a morning we landed in Japan someplace, and they refueled there. And then we went down to landed in Cameron Bay.
Did you sit on the plane there in Japan and not get off?
No, we got off. I think we landed in Air Force Base, and I remember there was a big hangar. They had like a snack bar, get a cup of coffee, a donut, soda or something, and that stuff.
And were you still with Charlie at four at this point? Was he kind of going over the same?
Yeah, we were. I don't think we sat together.
Right.
But
he was on the plane.
He was on the plane, and I'll tell you, I scared the hell out of me on that flight. I Left My Heart to San Francisco was one, and somebody had given me a book to read at the reception or at the replacement depot, and I read that, and it was, I can't even remember the author, but it was called "And Johnny Got His Gun."
Okay.
And it was written by it was an American communist. But it was about this guy in the First World War who was, he got hit by a shell or something, and he had no arms, legs, no eyes, ears, nose, nothing, and all he could do was just feel things.
Uh-huh.
And I read that and scared the hell out of me. But at the end, the message was, geez, it's so good. It's so nice to be alive. It was really crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But so, that was, I'll never forget that. But we got off the plane in Japan and got back on and went back.
Okay, and you said that you landed at Cameron Bay.
Yeah, Cameron Bay.
Do you remember your first, was it daytime when you landed?
Yeah, I think it was during the daylight, yeah.
Do you remember your sort of first sight of Vietnam?
It was basically the sandbag stuff, there's all these buildings with sandbags around them, or I'd say, low buildings, I don't really remember much else. I know they had us, I can't remember, I think they gave us jungle fatigues before at the replacement depot we had to turn in our uniforms, our duffel bags with all our military equipment other than our underwear and that stuff, and then they gave us, Did we travel in khakis? I'm not sure if we traveled in khakis. I think we traveled in khakis, and then we had our jungle fatigues, and we had to pack our khakis up and then put the jungle fatigues on and the jungle boots and that stuff. And then they had us filling sandbags.
And that's what you did when you first got there?
Yeah, yeah, just filled sandbags for a day or two or whatever. And, you know, I can't even remember how long I was in Cameron, but it wasn't very long. And then we caught a plane. I'm not sure what kind. I don't know if it was a Caribou or a C-123, but and then we flew from Cameron Bay to Ankay, which was a base camp of the first CAF.
Okay. And how many guys were on that flight from Cameron up to Ankay?
Pretty full. It was pretty full. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So
I 20. 20, 25 maybe.
Okay. What was your first impression of Ankay?
I think it was kind of like, you know, much more primitive than Cameron Bay.
In what ways?
Well, I mean, the living accommodations, you know, I don't even think they had a paved runway. I'm not sure. I think they just had that, you know, the interlocking metal grates for their runway. And it was, you know, obviously there's a perimeter with wire. Everybody's carrying guns, you know, or weapons,
right.
I should say, and that kind of thing. So you're in a war.
And you had the sense maybe for the first time that you
Pardon?
Were, was it your sense for the first time that you were in a war?
Yeah, yeah, because being in the, you know, at Cameron Bay, it was like being in the States, you know, and EM clubs and movie shows, and you know, we couldn't go, but we could see those things, and, you know, they had pretty good food, and they had ice machines, all that stuff. And
right.
They didn't really have that in Ankay.
What happened to you when you first arrived there? Who greeted you, and how did you get set up in your billet?
Well, then they greeted the plane, and then they put us all in a different barracks, because see, then we had to go through charm school. Everybody in the cab had to go through charm school.
Can you tell us what that was?
Well, at that point it was called the First Team Academy.
Uh-huh.
But they changed the name to something else because they didn't like the acronym, because in the Army, and excuse the language, but
okay.
the initials First Team Academy, everybody had written on things, FTA meant, fuck the Army.
Okay.
Yeah, so, yeah. Well, so we had for the First Team Academy, and it was basically the division's, I call it jungle school, that we all had to, I think we were issued our weapons there, and then we went through everybody, if you were a clerk or, you know, infantryman or artillery guy or engineer or whatever, we spent, it was about a week and a half, with weapons familiarization, you know, obviously we qualified with the M16, but shoot the M79 grenade launcher, pistols, the M60 machine gun, laws, shot those.
What was
that? A light anti-armor weapon.
Okay.
Which is a portable, one-shot and throwaway bazooka.
Okay.
So we used that. Fundamentals of patrolling. We would go on patrols during the day around the, you know, the terrain around the base camp,
mm-hmm.
and at night we would have to pull, you know, a perimeter security, practice rappelling off of towers and out of helicopters, and you know, practice walking down Jacob's ladders off of helicopters and
right.
that kind of stuff. It was great. I'll tell you, it was really great. Great orientation.
When you say it was great, can you elaborate?
Well, it got us used to the heat.
Okay.
Gave us some of the, and there were two instructors, and these guys were old pros, and yeah, they gave you all kinds of survival hints about what to pack and what not to pack, what to carry, don't worry about this and that.
Right.
You know, yeah, they just exuded confidence, like they knew what they were doing, and da 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 da. And then during this, then we got the lectures if we wanted to join the LERPs or, you know,
okay.
do this other stuff.
Uh-huh.
I don't think anybody did.
Right, and LERPs are
the long-range reconnaissance patrols.
Uh-huh. And why would you not want to join that?
Are you kidding? I don't want to be out in the bushes 20, you know, I don't want to be out of the bushes away from, you know, with three guys out, you know, out someplace where a lot of bad guys are at.
Right, and so they told you this was pretty much high-risk assignment.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
They told you that.
Well, they didn't tell us high-risk. They told us what they did.
Okay, and you...
Okay, fine. A helicopter drops you out someplace at night, and you're very quiet, and you observe the enemy, and you don't want to be seen by them. Okay, does that mean, well, if you're observing the enemy, then our guys ain't going to be around, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
You make the connection real quick.
Okay. Yeah. And not too many people...
No, I don't think... Maybe one guy did, but I don't think anybody did. Yeah.
Okay. And so this lasted, this period?
I want to say it was a week or 10 days, and then we were assigned to our units. And then we were assigned, because this was just a base camp. The whole division was away from the base camp, but everybody's rear area, rear echelon was still located in I think it's called Camp Holiday or whatever it was in Anquet.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I was assigned to the 1st of the 21st Artillery, which...
Right.
And they had a rear area which consisted of, I think there was a clerk and like a supply sergeant
mm-hmm.
there.
Did you receive that 1st of the 21st assignment after the
This
charm
was
school?
During that during the charm school.
Okay.
I got that, yeah.
And did you feel, you said that the instructors were exuding confidence about,
mm-hmm.
you know, about what the mission was and how
mm-hmm.
you were going to carry it out and the tools you would need. Did you absorb some of that confidence?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we all did. I mean, we weren't scared, you know.
Really?
We got over it. Hey, these guys are pros. This is, and it really hit us with a lot of the cab was a pretty tough unit.
Yes.
And it was, you know, and, man, we got out of there. We were sky troopers. You know, it was,
wow.
You know, we're, you know, it was like, hey, we're rough and tough. And just felt good about it. I mean, they basically answered the unknown.
Right.
You know, and okay, now this is, you know, everybody knew fire and maneuver, but now we're doing it. And it was just amazing, you know, just amazing.
I
think we all felt pretty confident about it, you know. I don't know if I'd have felt the same way if I was going to an infantry unit as a rifleman, but,
Right. But you sort of felt charged like this, and this might have been the first time that you really felt confident.
Well, now I'm there, and I'm seeing people that lived the life, you know, and now I have something I can relate to.
Right.
You know,
right.
It's not that, you know, it's not going to be a horrible, you know, getting shot at every minute of the day, and you know, that kind of thing. And it's just now the unknown is known, and you know, I start feeling confident. Yeah.
Right. And so when you reported to the 21st
yeah.
Artillery. Where was that from Anquet?
Well, now see, I was assigned to A Battery, and A Battery was, I have to backtrack. It was a direct support 105 Howitzer unit, and
okay.
Now the Air Cavalry was a little different. They had four rifle companies instead of three with a headquarters and heavy weapons company. So they had four rifle companies. The biggest organic support that the rifle company would have would be, I think each one carried two 81 millimeter mortars. But the philosophy was that a battery of artillery of 105 howitzers was assigned to each battalion of the CAV. So there were what, nine maneuver battalions in the CAV. I was first of the 21st was assigned to the 3rd Brigade, so there was the 1st of the 7th, 2nd of the 7th, and I think it was the 5th of the 7th CAV. And so then each rifle company had this direct support battery that it operated with. We always operated within, the 105 Howitzer has probably a maximum range of about 11,000 meters, and, so they always, the 2nd and 7th CAV always basically operated within that range. So they didn't have to have any organic heavy weapons per se, and they could have more people beat in the bushes as infantrymen.
So they could operate, in effect, under the umbrella of the 105.
Right, exactly. And so I was assigned to A Battery, which was assigned to support the 2nd and 7th CAV. And they were detached from the brigade, and they were detached from the division, and they were in the extreme southeastern corner of Tukor around the city of Phan Thiet. And they were there on Operation Byrd, that's B-Y-R-D. And that had started probably a year before I got there. A little history. I think the 2nd of 7th was about annihilated in the Idrang Valley. And you saw the movie We Were Soldiers Once. I don't know if you saw that.
Yes.
That was about the 1st of the 7th. Well, after the movie ends, the replacement troops are walking. Mel Gibson's group, the 1st of the 7th, air evac out. The 2nd of 7th walked out. And in the process of walking out, they walked through a horrendous ambush where they lost about 150 guys.
Okay.
And so I think, I'm not sure, but I think as, you know, as the division was, as they were refitting, they assigned them down to this Operation Bird, which started out as a, I think it started out as a guard to rice harvest type of operation.
Okay.
And they just stayed there. And in fact, it was the only, self-contained battalion task force, in the Vietnam conflict, was down there. So that's I went to the 1st to the 21st headquarters in An Ke. They said, hey, you're an A battery. You'll catch a flight tomorrow. We'll take you down to Phan Thiet and you can join the battery. Okay. And so both Charlie and I, we both went down there. Yeah. And so then we went down there and we joined the battery, which was it was down there. It was split because it was a pretty big area of operations. So they had three guns on firebase or LZ called Bartlett, and they had three guns that were on a firebase or landing zone called Judy. And then Judy would usually move when, you know, if they extended their area of operations, the three guns at Judy would usually move out to support operations that were exceeding the, you know, outside of the fan.
I was just going to ask about Operation Bird.
Uh-huh.
And that this operation had been going on for well over a year. You arrived in September 1967.
Mm-hmm.
How much and from whom did you learn about Operation Bird's kind of back history before you arrived there?
Nothing. You know, they just said they're down there. I had no idea where they were. I didn't even know the operation's name until I was reading something, you know.
Later?
About 10 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't know. I had no idea what the hell they called it. You know,
okay.
I didn't really care.
And they did not give you information. You're part of this big operation and you're...
No, they basically just, this is where we're at and we're supporting the 2nd and 7th Cav. That's it. Okay.
Okay. And when you first went down to the Phan Thiet area, where did you actually go? Did you go to one of the LZs?
Well, yeah, I landed in Phan Thiet, which was a around the airfield. They called that LZ Betty for some reason or another. And they had some base units were there.
Uh-huh.
And then we were only there, I don't know, maybe a couple hours, and then we took a helicopter out to LZ Bartlett, which was way up in the hills, and it was only accessible by a helicopter.
Do you remember that helicopter ride?
Yeah, yeah.
Was that have been your first?
We rode helicopters in Charm School
and
rappelled out of them. So it was, you know, basically they'd run a supply helicopter out there 2-3 times a day or something, and, you know, they'd take people back and forth, and, you know, it was like a cab.
It was like a cab?
Yeah, in fact, they called them, the last one of the night was called the Yellow Cab. Yeah, so I don't know why, but that's what they called it.
When you got out to Bartlett, could you describe what you saw?
Well, it was very hilly terrain, very rough, hilly, wooded terrain, and here was this place carved out. It probably had the area of maybe a football field, you know, although not shaped like a football field. It had to follow the top of the hill, and a lot of bunkers, a lot of holes. They had the guns, had their parapet. They had three howitzers out there. They had their parapets built up, and a lot of fighting positions around the, the perimeter.
Mm-hmm.
And you're in the woods now. You're
right.
Yeah.
And who did you report to?
Well, I can't remember that. You know, we had obviously somebody met us, and then I can't remember who met us there, and then they took us down to the company commander for a minute, and I can't even remember his name, because he left, or I should say the battery commander, he left, maybe 2-4 weeks at the most after I got there. And but then when they... First sergeant, somebody introduced us to the first sergeant, and then he introduced us to the battery commander, and then he took us into FDC and wanted to see what we can do.
Okay, that would be the fire direction center.
Yeah, and the fire direction control center.
What did he want to find out?
Well, he put us behind a chart and said, they called out a fire mission and just see if we could, plug it in the grid, get the right grid plugged in and give them the exact, the firing data at that point, the range and deflection.
Okay. And,
I did it and Charlie couldn't. He forgot because, it was, this was maybe, 6-7 months after we finished that school.
Right. It's been a while since you had done this.
Yeah.
And, so you kind of aced that first test.
Yeah.
Charlie didn't.
So
what did
I can't remember because I think the battery was laid out. See they would have big charting tables.
Yeah.
I can't remember what the battery orientation was, but he just read it backwards. If zero, and they wouldn't use degrees, they used mils. It was, you had 6,400 mils in a circle.
Okay.
And, a lot of times they would, south would be 3,200 mils, but if the battery was orientated to the south, south was 0 mils, okay?
Right,
and
right.
He just got it backwards or
okay.
something. I can't remember
right.
what he did, but.
And he pulled through somehow?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And where did they take you?
Well, off of, they had a working area in this bunker, mm-hmm. and then kind of a part of this bunker was also made into living quarters. It was the working. It was kind of like an L shaped, and the flat part of the L was the fire direction center, where basically all they had was two chart tables and a little desk, portable desk, where the computer would sit. And when I say computer, I'm talking about a person, not
right.
a machine.
Right, the person.
And with a bunch of Prick 25 radios over there.
What
and,
kind of radios?
PRC, Prick 25, PRC 25 radios.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And there was, you had one chart, well, one chart was a check chart, and I think in that operation, one of the guys on the check charts also operated as the check on the computer, too.
Okay.
So you'd always check the data twice.
Right.
Yeah.
Can you describe what the check chart was?
It was the same thing. You both plotted the data, okay? You had a range, you had this chart table, and you had your range deflection protractor on there. A Ford observer, you'd hear it on the radio, call, fire mission over, and then he'd give a grid reference. And basically, you would just stick a pin in the grid reference on your chart,
right.
hit it with your range, with the protractor, you would have the flat side would be your range. You would read off range, and then the check chart, the guy on the check chart would do the same thing.
Okay.
And I'd say range 6400 or 6450, and the check guy would say range check, and then you'd say deflection 2830 or whatever, and then he would say deflection 2830 check.
And so it was a sort of a redundant system
to
ensure accuracy.
You bet.
Okay.
And then the computer guy would he's on the horn saying fire, usually calling the base piece fire mission, and then he would give him the deflection. So then doing that, then he would from that range with a slide rule, he would figure out the quadrant, the up and down of the gun. And that was depending on, that was range driven because, the range would drive the charge. You had 7 possible charges that could be fired.
Okay.
And, then he would, take, like take the, had a little like a slide rule. He'd say, okay, on a charge 7, a range of, I don't know, whatever it was, you know, like 9,000 meters, he would slide it 9,000 meters, I'd get the quadrant.
Uh-huh.
And then he would call the quadrant to the gun. He'd call the quadrant, and then you'd have a check computer. This, because the battery was split, you had a lot of guys that do the same thing. You follow me?
Yes.
I had to do more than one job, so
yes.
Usually the guy in the check chart would also have the slide rules, and then he would check the quadrant as well,
yes.
And then he'd call it to the gun and then fire.
And when he called it to the gun, then they, who made the decision about which of the charges would be used?
Oh, the computer would.
Okay. So he would call the gun and he would say, this is the charge that you used.
Yeah, he would call a fire mission and usually he would call, you know, you usually shot with your base piece first.
With your base piece?
Yeah, this is what all the other guns were orientated to.
Got it. Okay.
You know, and, because, and it was set up like, you know, if you shot the same data, if your gun is 50 meters away, you're shooting the same data. My gun will hit at that 50 meter place away. If
yes.
Only.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. They would if firing exactly the same. Because they would the shells would land in the same distribution in
right.
The field as the,
as they're set up on.
The
yeah.
Gun in places.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The LZ. Yeah.
And range usually dictated charge, so they say, and all the 105 howitzer was semi-fixed ammunition. And that means it just looked like a bullet, you know, if it looked like a huge bullet, but you could take the warhead off, and then the powder was there in bags.
Uh-huh.
So if it was a charge 6, you would just break off the first bag and throw it away. And
okay, so it came loaded with 7.
Yeah, it came loaded with 7.
And then you broke it down.
Yeah.
Okay. And, Mike, you said that the configuration of the, I guess it's the FDC, was actually kind of L-shaped?
Yeah, it was like an L-shaped bunker, yeah.
And part of it was billeting? Part of it was quarters.
Living quarters, yeah. You had had some bunks built out of old ammo boxes.
Okay, yeah. Out of old ammo boxes.
Yeah, the 105 howitzers would come, two rounds to a nice pine box.
Okay,
and they would have a piece of tar paper in between them, and then they'd be wrapped in like Visqueen or something, you know, some clear plastic.
Right.
So, and obviously, as they emptied those boxes, you had a lot of boxes around, so you'd break them apart and build stuff out of it.
Okay, and who was actually quartered in that area?
The fire direction people were. Yeah.
And did that include you at this time?
I was assigned there. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And Charlie was too, and then we went to the field later for a while. Yeah.
Okay. How long were you actually assigned there?
Well, yeah, I was in and out. See, we had not as I said, we're direct support battery. So then the battery had to supply FO parties to each company in the battalion.
Okay. And by FO, you mean
forward observer parties.
Okay. And those people did what?
Well, would basically call in artillery fire.
Okay. They would tell where it needed to hit.
Yeah, they'd be with the infantry, and they'd call in to fire, or the infantry could get on the artillery net and call it in as well. But, you know, and each party was supposed to have an officer, a recon sergeant, and a radio operator.
Okay.
But because, you know, 9 times out of 10, there wasn't an officer out in the field.
Okay. And you were saying that you at first were assigned to the FDC party at LZ Bartlett, but
mm-hmm.
You kind of moved around.
Yeah, and I did some stints out in the field. I was pretty cautious, you know, about doing it, but I did it. You know, I went to some FO parties for a while and you know, in and out, but usually housed in FDC, and a lot of times, we would be out on a, when a battery's set up, or a portion of the battery's set up, then the infantry element is assigned for basically to secure it. You know, let's say, so they may have a platoon down to secure the battery.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other platoons of the company are out and about doing their own thing for, you know, might be, you know, one day, might be several days at a time. So then a lot of times the base secure force would then they would have to patrol the area in proximity to the, you know, to wherever you're at. And because we are always short on people in FO parties, a lot of us would go with the patrols for the base, you know, the base defense force. You know, so the FO resources could be with the, you know, with the other platoons that are further out in the bush.
They were out patrolling a little bit longer range, mm-hmm, from the LZ.
Yeah.
Okay, Mike, let's take a break for a moment.
Okay.